The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Randall Robinson, who were Maxie and Doris Robinson?
Maxie Robinson was my father, and Doris Robinson was my mother. And as I've already introduced you to them, they had strong opinions, and they were extraordinary parents, and they were extremely principled people. I remember when my brother Max was with ABC News as the Chicago anchor, and he had gone to Smith College to make a speech, and he said some things critical of ABC, and I was so proud of him because in him I saw my father and the kinds of things that he had stood for when we were children.
Did that hurt Max Robinson's career at ABC?
Oh, it sure did. But I don't think there's any question about that. But I think he thought, as much as he loved his work, he thought there were a few things more important than giving the news.
Defending the Spirit, August 1982. Just want to read a couple lines. The family is also worried about Max. He has become rich and famous, but he is not happy. He is a journalist, but he reads the news, and he is not pleased with himself.
He wanted to do more than that. He wanted to cover conventions. He wanted to comment. He wanted to interpret the news. And he was being asked to accept the role of reading copy. He wasn't happy with that, no.
When did he die?
Let's see. The year, it's been about 20 years now. He died when he was 49.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today is Friday, April 1, 2016. So I have been told. That was Randall Robinson, author and scholar, commenting. He did an interview in 2013 on C-SPAN. He was discussing his family and specifically his brother, journalist, the late Max Robinson. This is our book club fifth installment, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World. We are beyond the halfway point of the book, coming down the home stretch. I hope it has been constructive and informative for our listeners. I played that segment at the beginning of the program. I mentioned Max Robinson at the beginning of last week's program, or actually in the middle of the discussion during last week's segment. And I said that I see a lot of parallels between Leonida McLean and Max Robinson. They both died very young, way too young, in my opinion. They were both black journalists. They both called out racism within the journalism profession. They were both trailblazers during the 1980s. They both worked in the Chicago area. Many, many parallels between the two. I guess to wrap everything up, this is continuing the segment. You heard the white male who was interviewing Randall Robinson, Max's brother. He read a segment from Defending the Spirit. And this just continues where he's talking about Max Robinson. So you heard about the family being worried about him because he's a journalist. He is a journalist, but he reads the news and he is not pleased with himself. It was Jewel who always aspired to be an actor. Max, I fear, now despairs that he has become one. The network has given him far less opportunity to practice interpretive journalism than it has afforded many of his colleagues, some of whom are not anchors and doubtless are less talented than he. It rankles him that he has not been assigned to cover a national political convention or other event of that magnitude. The work climate in which he now finds himself could be both cause and effect of a speech he made recently at Smith College, in which he charged that American news organizations, including his own, are infected with racism. ABC executives were upset. Max had only told the truth. Ask black journalists, many of whom Max has gone well out of his way to assist in their apprenticeship. He is a gifted man, troubled by a racist work environment he has remarked on to his detriment. Sounds a lot like Leonida McLean. With that, we will get started. Context of White Supremacy, A Foot in Each World. Leonida McLean, edited by her former husband, also a black journalist, Clarence Page. Audio segment number one.
December 11th, 1983. Unequal cultures, unsavory pasts. If mayoral aide Clarence McLean, a convicted panderer, had become a minister or were running a community center for troubled children, he would be the subject of feature stories on the worthiness of rehabilitation. Instead, he is aiding the mayor in making political and governmental decisions and is being soundly and rightly blasted for it. At the Chicago Housing Authority, Michael Buford, 39, the brother-in-law acting chairman Renault Robinson put on the payroll, has an arrest record for robbery from his days as a teen gang leader. And now, the police records of staffers in the Department of Neighborhoods are being revealed, including the record of Acting Commissioner Joseph Gardner, who has a 1978 conviction on a gun charge. One staffer described as McLean's chauffeur, neighbors Jake Miles, has a record of arrests on charges of assault and contributing to the delinquency of a child. A first deputy has a conviction for defrauding the state unemployment compensation program. Another aide was convicted of disorderly conduct. It is impossible to dismiss these records simply as past mistakes. Some of the indiscretions are unpardonable, but they must be examined more astutely. The employees in question have families to protect and reputations they have tried to rebuild. They should not be used by either faction as political darts or to whip up cries of racism, though you can almost hear amid the inquiries, "See what those people are like?" A public employee's record should be disclosed if it shows serious indiscretions and if the employee holds a fairly high-level position. Disclosures of this kind have occurred in past administrations, and this may be only the beginning of revelations about the Washington administration's black and white members. Yet, it is not enough to say that better people should be hired. Among blacks in particular, even the very best and the brightest in any field run a greater risk than whites do of having been suspected or accused of a crime, and certainly of knowing someone who has. This explains why the mayor's own transgressions were embarrassing to some black people, but were not enough to keep them from voting for him. Stop 10 black men and 10 white men on the street, and you are likely to prove this theory by inquiring solely about traffic violations. The reason for the discrepancy is not that blacks are worse people or more dishonest or more prurient, as the twisted mentality of bigotry maintains. The reason is too often this very negativism, which accuses and tries blacks instantaneously. On the other hand, let's not be Pollyannas. The reason can also be that someone is just a guilty good-for-nothing.
Still, the social factors behind the disproportionate black contact with the criminal justice system have to be acknowledged. I am not offering the old excuse about poor, disadvantaged, one-parent, aimless youth being let off because of their pathetic life circumstances. Yet, if you have any sense of fair play, you have to admit that those circumstances might somehow contribute to delinquent behavior. If criminal infractions seem less relevant to blacks, it is not because blacks find them excusable or see everyone as redeemable. Indeed, blacks can be most harsh concerning punishment because they are victimized by crime more often and know its cruelties better. But they also understand what may have driven someone to commit a crime. They know that a suspicion is sometimes as good as a conviction where someone black is concerned. So they give the benefit of the doubt, knowing that the accused black frequently has not been afforded it. This negativism presumes that a black victim or witness is less credible, too. A police officer may stop a black kid and haul him in for hanging out, but he will just shoo away a white kid or take him home. The black burglar who gets caught in an industrial plant is dealt with more harshly and appears more menacing than a white president of the firm who is caught defrauding investors. White-collar crime really is white. A black woman dressed impeccably is more apt to be suspected of shoplifting in an exclusive store than is a white person who is dressed sloppily. But these are hypothetical examples. The city employees under fire have been involved in the real thing. I enter my plea on black versus white criminality not to apologize for these specific cases or allege that the city workers were falsely accused or were victims of discrimination. I only wish to explain that the fact of different circumstances requires different judgments about people's pasts. The futures of these men in city government will have to be determined case by case. The mayor and McLean, no relation for the curious, can socialize and consult as much as they please, but the mayor should not have McLean in the environs of City Hall acting as liaison in official matters. The worst crime against Buford is being Robinson's brother-in-law. Hit Robinson on that. Don't knock Buford for youthful recklessness going back 20 years. There seems no reason why Gardner cannot run the Department of Neighborhoods or why Miles cannot drive a car, though Miles and McLean's offenses are most repulsive. There may be reason for concern if the convicted defrauder has a job with the chance to defraud again, but isn't that prejudgment unfair? The disorderly conduct charge is not worth addressing. A black person buying chewing gum at a newsstand can be picked up for that. This furor is ultimately a clash of two separate and unequal cultures finally meeting head on as equals. And unfortunately, the collision is in the very public halls of government. January 8, 1984. Harold Washington, Gladiator. Harold Washington was elected mayor of Chicago, but his greatest role has been as gladiator. He has been fending off the lions in the city council. His election put him into national prominence and pitted him against President Reagan and against his own national party. He has even done battle with his key black supporters in the first congressional district race. And he will be dueling doubly in the March 20th primary, attacking with one hand the issue of Jesse Jackson's presidential candidacy and delegate selection to the National Convention, and with the other, his nemesis, Alderman Edward Fridoliak, 10th, and the Cook County Democratic Party in the ward committeeman races. Through it all, Washington has found time to be mayor, and to be a good one, I think. Were it not for the maniac racial character of this town, people, especially white, might be able to see the uncanny irony in this fact. Harold Washington has emancipated them and given them good government. What they had before was no better than Moscow's Politburo with the party and government as one. Now the party and government are not one. And therein lies Washington's occasional undoing. Washington's job would be much easier if he were both party and government, but he is not. As a mayor, Washington has opened up the business process of this city with the Freedom of Information Act, taken on labor on the prevailing wage, tossed out thousands of payrollers, involved bright, responsive, hardworking, multi-ethnic people in the management of this city, people who have expertise beyond hiring their relatives. Not that they or the mayor are pure in that regard. Most recently, he gave Chicago a real budgetary process with the able hand of already missed David Schultz, the departing city budget director. No matter what the bottom line was or which department was being saved or punished by the numbers, the fact remains that no mayor had ever thought enough of the brain power of the aldermen to give them a full month to review the city's finances. And then, of course, given the extra time, the opposition ungraciously whipped out an alternative budget. Washington is mayor, but can he also be a boss, even of only a small fraction of a party? He is certainly trying in the coming ward committee men races. But if the mayor is a different kind of mayor, he is proving to be a different kind of boss, too. He will never be boss in the daily sense for more than reasons of color. There is a difference between a boss and a leader. The leadership Washington displays in government only seems lacking when translated to the party. His campaign offices are busy enough, and he will be supporting a cadre of black, white, and Hispanic candidates on and off the county ticket in ward and in ward races. The criticism of disorganization that plagued Washington before his election and during the early days of his administration are being repeated about Washington as party leader. Can the Washington who gathered the popular vote gather together a bunch of politicians? His fiercest battle in the arena may be this one with a two-headed local party. When the regular party's county slate was rejected by angry black committeemen who stalked out, their threatened alternative lineup never came together. It was doomed by old-line black political versus born-again Washingtonians versus slighted suburban black party members and may never have had the mayor's blessing anyway. The infighting and many challenges now in the implicably convoluted petition filings for ward committeemen also are making his organization appear inept. The odds seem against him because of the disorganization, because he is fighting on too many fronts, and because his opponents are in their own right formidable, and whatever disorganization they have never seem to be played up publicly. The disparity between Washington, the disorganized candidate who became a quick study mayor, and Washington, that seemingly disorganized party leader, may prove not so great. Before turning thumbs down, remember that Washington, the gladiator, knows well the jaws of the lion. March 4th, 1984. Is Navy Pier up Zweibel's sleeve? One of the first political lessons anyone learns in Chicago is there are no coincidences. And there certainly are no coincidences when Charles Zweibel is involved. So when Zweibel's periscope was sighted in the waters off Navy Pier, it was not a supernatural occurrence. Zweibel is always there when he needs you.
Reports that Zweibel had a plan for Navy Pier surfaced only after a special joint session of two city council committees, special events, and the worlds of fair and ports, wharves and bridges, scuttled the mayor's request for continued negotiations with Rouse and Company, developers on a $277 million shopping complex at Navy Pier. The report surfaced and submerged so speedily they hardly caused a blip. But there had to be something on that radar screen. Mayor Harold Washington and Public Works Commissioner Jerome Butler had asked that the deadline for talks with Rouse be extended from mid-February to June 30th. The committee said no in a 15-5 vote weighted by the opposition 29 block. The committees weren't voting on money or blueprints or any such tangible matter, just on whether the mayor should keep negotiating with Rouse. Of course, many of these aldermen lined up behind Jane Byrne 3 years ago when she proposed turning the lakefront White Elephant into a shopping bazaar. They would never have voted to muzzle her, even when she had nothing to say. And there wasn't much to the plan then except Byrne's noted grandiosity. But it looked and sounded good because Rouse and Company from Maryland had an impressive list of similar developments. In Milwaukee, Baltimore, Boston, and other cities, Rouse helped replenish urban vitality and revenues. Alderman Edward Verdoliak, who led the charge against Mayor Washington's proposal, called the Navy Pier plan a pig and a poke. That was true under Byrne. Lately, though, there seemed to be something of worth wriggling around in that poke. It still is an iffy proposition, just because of the cost of renovating the building and grounds. But it is certainly worth pursuing, and it is the mayor's right to study ways to ensure the economic future of Chicago. The mayor himself took a long time in deciding to back the plan. He was asked about it often during the campaign and was noncommittal even after taking office. But once he was convinced of its worth, Robert Meyer in Economic Development, Liz Hollander in Planning, and Butler, a Byrne holdover, got to work. They actually had begun to find common ground with Rouse, although the city had mispromised deadlines on an agreement. There was a tentative plan for $40 million in UDAG, Urban Development Action Grant funding, which would have saved city money. The plan fell through, but it showed that officials were thinking and moving. In late January, the mayor met with Rouse in Washington and received a promise from the company to help finance neighborhood projects and to allow space for local entrepreneurs in the Navy Pier Bazaar. Rouse has made such concessions to municipalities before. The deal was in the formative stages, but the anticipated $15 million in revenue and Rouse's track record were making the risks seem worth taking. Even the State Street and Michigan Avenue merchants, who have the most to lose if Navy Pier works, reluctantly advise continuing the talks. Now enters Charles Zweibel, who is certainly familiar with the real estate development business at the high end, given his involvement in Marina City condominium dealings, and at the low end, with the 20 years as head of the Chicago Housing Authority. Navy Pier is a considerable piece of property for anyone to take on, but Zweibel could turn it to some good use for everyone to share in, especially some cronies on the 29 side. No sooner was the committee vote tallied than it was disclosed that Zweibel had a brilliant idea for Navy Pier in which the Ohio millionaire DiBartolo family, one-time prospective buyer of the White Sox would take Rouse's place. Swible, it seems, made the offer 2 months ago to Ira Bach, the mayor's director of city development. I am not above thinking there is no coincidence on the administration side in revealing this conversation after the committee vote. The DiBartolos denied that Swible represented them or that they had plans for or interest in Navy Pier. It is highly likely that Swible has something up his sleeve, and it is a sure bet that the vote against continued negotiations with Rouse had a lot to do with whatever it was. March 28, 1984. County Hospital, Hope for the Poor. Cook County Hospital is a hellhole. Cook County Hospital is a life preserver. The Grand Dam of Harrison Street is much maligned, but it seems dishonest for those who have never suffered with her to be so quick to denigrate her. All most people know of Cook County is that they never want to go there. And it seems that with the never-ending fiscal crisis, the disregard for its staff, the patchwork rehabilitation, some would mercilessly write off County and the thousands of indigent for whom there is no other harbor. While the horror stories of Cook County are not overstated, the good that goes on there is too often understated. Until I was an adult, I had no idea that doctors' offices had comfy cushioned seats, magazines, and music, or that in other hospitals, privacy was the norm. Whenever anyone sneezed in our household, she was bundled up and deposited into the cauldron of humanity at Cook County. There was no need to explain why we always drove by other hospitals to venture to the west side. The reason was the same then as it is now. Other hospitals do not want you if you do not have health insurance or instant cash. Better to go to County on your own than to be referred there. The less polite word is dumped. A society that discriminates among the sick is itself diseased, but such is life and death at Cook County. As a child, I sat in the emergency room on backless pews, feverish and congested for 4 hours because the form that was filled out upon arrival was inevitably lost. The promise to be called shortly was met somewhere within the next 2 hours. It is the hellhole where my sister lay motionless for days, the doctors fearing polio but diagnosing some mysterious virus. It is the hellhole where my mother was revived from a diabetic coma and returned home 3 dress sizes smaller. Too young to visit her, I remember standing on the sidewalk below and waving to her as she leaned against the window. What went on those upper floors was a mystery to me until the next year, 1964. In March, it was the broken leg and an overnight stay in a cramped ward where one woman's groans finally were silenced by a resounding shut up from her fellow patients. By fall, it was chickenpox at 13 and a week's stay in the old contagious wing. I know Cook County Hospital knew her in her old disgrace. There are those who do not know her. They do not know the bizarre expressions of love that are exchanged by a sobbing couple after one has shot or stabbed the other, and the accompanying police officers who stoically set about the required paperwork, having seen this movie before. They do not know what it is like to be in pain and lean up against a wall or to wait an hour and a half for a prescription at Fannis Clinic, Fantasy Clinic, as every patient mispronounces it. They do not know what it is like to be condescended by a doctor or nurse with a foreign accent or to demand respect and attention with a desperate shriek. Cook County has never been a place of silence. All they know is that they don't want to go there, don't have to go there. They do not understand that there are people without a choice or for whom the choice is made without their consultation in another hospital's emergency room. Of course, there are those who do care and who want to save County. But the question is money, always money, and whether anyone cares enough to spend it on the poor. The Cook County Board knows the need, but it also knows the cost, about $300 million to replace the old building. There is no doubt that the hospital should be sustained, whether in a new building or a series of more accessible satellite facilities. Cook County may always be a hellhole to some, but to the poor, that hole is the middle of the floating life preserver. April 22, 1984. Crimes against free expression. The 1969 raid on the Black Panthers, mentioned in paragraph 8, was led by then state's attorney Edward Hanrahan. It resulted in the violent deaths of Panthers leaders Mark Clark and Fred Hampton, and the demise of the political career of Hanrahan, who was voted out of office in 1972. Let us now hail no ideas. That's no ideas, not new ideas. No ideas is what President Reagan's administration is about. Of course, he and his loyalists have ideas aplenty. It's just everyone else's ideas that they want to stifle. He and his administration have crept up on free expression, intent on strangling it. Their actions are regressive and dangerous, and though they can't see it, un-American. The free flow of opinions is this nation's very reason for being. It has worked amazingly well for more than 200 years, but Reagan would quash it. The gagging has been carried out in stealth and with such effectiveness that most people probably have not noticed that the Constitution is being debased. There is a Reagan view of the world, and everyone ought to share it. It's the reincarnation of love it or leave it. This administration's disregard of rights was fully unmasked last week in the president's directive on terrorism. Though the details were not told, the rules reportedly include more and presumably more unfettered intelligence gathering and reprisals to protect U.S. citizens on the domestic and foreign fronts. Secretary of State George Shultz, showing he can stand as tall and hang as tough as his boss, said the intent of the directive is to show an active defense that might entail preventive or preemptive action. It's the tired old national security excuse for everything from bashing heads to exploding cigars to who knows what. This administration is out looking for something in which to interfere. Where is Salvador Allende when we need him? Obviously, all nations hope to thwart or to punish terrorists. The consistent and frightening signs from this administration are that an active defense may be applied, or rather unleashed, domestically after years of trying to reverse the abuses of infiltration during the protest movements of the 1960s. The terms being used previously applied to nuclear war strategy. What was the 1969 raid on the Black Panthers on the West Side but a preventive or preemptive action? But the missive on terrorism is just part of a pattern that reveals the
administration's alarmist and paranoid tendencies. Remember, this is the administration that wanted to plug its leaks by requiring lie detector tests for more than 2 million randomly selected employees in the civilian and military services and another 1.5 million workers with government contractors. Those who refuse could be subject to adverse employment action. A nice bit of euphemistic double talk. Another part of that brilliant plan was to have 100,000 federal employees sign secrecy agreements requiring them to submit anything they wrote concerning intelligence even after leaving office for pre-publication review. At a hearing on those proposals last year, former Undersecretary of State George Ball warned, or was it prophesized, that we should be very careful in our obsession with the Soviet Union, that we don't imitate their methods and become much more like them. There is still more evidence of this administration's police state mentality. It reversed domestic spying rules for the FBI last year, rules that were clamped on because of overzealousness during the 1960s and 70s. The changes would authorize infiltration and other extreme measures now in a period that is tranquil, indeed comatose, compared with those days of sit-ins and marches and university building takeovers. And capping the list of crimes against free expression is the news blackout on the invasion of Grenada. There is but one reality, Reagan's reality, and it is one-dimensional. This flag-waving administration ought to review its American history and the role dissent has played in helping to preserve democracy. April 25th, 1984. Olive Branch says who, buddy? In one of her rare satires, Leah uses as a vehicle Chicago Week in Review, an intelligently packaged public television program hosted by attorney journalist Joel Wiseman. Mayor Harold Washington and Alderman Edward Verdoliak have extended olive branches, but neither has reached for the other's offering. Announcer. And now, City Hall Week in Review, with your host, Noel Wiseman. Wiseman. Good evening and welcome to this very special edition of City Hall Week in Review. Tonight, we're going to discuss whether the city's blacks or the city's whites started the political mess we're in. We're also compare the IQ scores of the two automatic factions in the council. And last, we'll explore whether those new experimental lift garbage cans in five wards are what's causing a mysterious outbreak of dyspepsia among precinct captains. Our guests are Mayor Harold Washington. Washington looks to camera, smiles. And 10th Ward Alderman Edward Verdoliak, leader of the Majority 29 block in the City Council and newly re-elected Cook County Democratic Party chairman. Verdoliak looks to camera, smiles. Together for the first time here on this show, thinks to himself, eat your heart out, Jacobson. To get started, gentlemen, you first have to turn your chairs around and look at each other. Neither Washington nor Verdoliak budges. Wiseman. Come on, guys, turn around. At least turn around and admire this funny custom-made trapezoid table we have in order to give everyone around it a chance to be a star, especially those newspaper and radio people. The chairs began to swivel, then stop. Waiting for the right moment, both politicians turn around to the table simultaneously. Verdoliak, showing surprise. So, you're Harold Washington.
You raced off so fast from the council your first day on the job last May, I hardly remember you. Hardly seen you since. Devilish smile. Washington. Why, you scurrilous Wiseman. Mr. Mayor, you'll have to save that kind of talk for the council. I think we ought to remind our viewers that this is the first time the two of you have gotten together, not just on this show, but for the first time ever since your election. I figured if Cronkite could do it with Begin and Set It, so could I. Let's start with you, Mr. Mayor. What do you think about the racial Washington? I'm getting tired of that question. I said I was going to be the mayor of this city, all of this city, and I am. I say that unequivocally. What I want to get across to the people of this city is that I turn my chair faster than Fast Eddie did tonight. Verdoliak, you did not. Washington, did too. Wiseman, look, we only have a 30-minute show, and I've got to squeeze in all the questions I brought up in the opening, so quit it already. Alderman Verdoliak, what about that it's a racial thing statement? Wasn't it the first salvo in this battle? Verdoliak, that's past, gone. I want your viewers to know that I offered to meet with the mayor no less than 433 times just in the last week. And even though I said I'm not going to negotiate in the media, I got 433 stories about my extending the olive branch and turning over a new leaf and becoming Nice Eddie. Tonight is my big chance to show my new image, and you have me seated for my worst profile. Washington, the media never understand me or my culture. I made that offer first and a total of 527 times, but the funky media only reported it 5 times. Wiseman, Mr. Mayor, just what do you mean when you use the term funky? Washington, see, you're what I mean. You don't understand me. Wiseman, let's turn to another subject. The Verdoliak, jumping up from the table and pointing his finger at Washington. He kicked me. He kicked me. Did you get that on camera? The mayor of the city of Chicago kicked me in the shins right here on the air. Washington lunges across the table. Verdoliak, hey, bub, don't muss my bulletproof vest. Washington, I knew this was going to happen. I should have never agreed to this. You scurrilous, spurious, antediluvian, doo-doo, funky, lowlife. Wiseman, ever composed. Speaking of low, we're just about out of time. We'd like to thank our guests, Mayor Harold Washington and Alderman Edward Verdoliak, for their joint appearance. Hey, no fighting on the tabletop. Good night. May 2nd, 1984, and we will all sink together. Blacks are talking a third-party county election challenge, and ethnic whites are setting agendas and becoming overnight Republicans. But we will all be naysayers when the national media point out Chicago's race problem. What race problem? There wouldn't be any race problem. Every side insists if those people would just do right or go away or try togetherness. Integration won't have a chance here before it's buried, and few will even lament it. It doesn't matter now which side started it or is keeping it up, for when it is finished, everyone will sink together. In the midst of this insanity, voices of reason are drowned out. Last week, some 100 business, union, and civic leaders issued a Chicago covenant to stress their concern about the injection of racial antagonisms into politics and the struggle for neighborhood improvement, which is fragmenting and polarizing the city along racial and ethnic lines. The covenant begins, "We, the undersigned, are citizens who love Chicago and believe in its future. It is bolstered by such names as Warren Bacon, executive of Inland Steel Corp., Edwin C. Bill Berry, Rabbi Herbert Bronstein of the Chicago Board of Rabbis, Gail Sincotta, National People's Action, James W. Compton of the Chicago Urban League, Monsignor John Egan of the Chicago Roman Catholic Archdiocese, William Lee, Chicago Federation of Labor, John McDermott, the Chicago Reporter Newsletter, Reverend Jorge Morales, Reverend Kenneth B. Smith, former school board president, and Rabbi Arnold Wolf, Temple CAM. It continues, we respect Mayor Harold Washington as our chief magistrate and call on all citizens to give him the respect and cooperation which he and his office deserve. We also call on the mayor, the chairman of the Democratic Party, members of the city council, and all community leaders to set a good example by addressing the serious issues facing our city with dedication and civility.
The sentiment of the covenant is admirable and futile. For meanwhile, the jousting goes on in the city council. The majority bloc will stand firm against allowing Mayor Washington to buy even a new push broom for the next 3 years so that when he tries to point to his accomplishments, they can gloat that he has been ineffective. And they, of course, will have been far too effective.
The mayor would rather be combative than mayoral, and given the obstreperousness of the opposition, it is hard to blame him. But good government will indeed be good politics if he gets his staff's agenda together. White ethnics are holding conventions to formulate an agenda as if the agenda hasn't been theirs for all of history. What is it that white ethnics fear? Is their garbage not being picked up? Aren't their street lamps on? Just how many blacks have moved onto their blocks since Washington's election? Their concern is neighborhoods, and so is Mayor Washington's. But they find it inconceivable that a black mayor could treat them fairly, given that blacks were mistreated at the hands of white mayors for so long. Many blacks talk loosely of a third party overlooking that they could not defeat bad apples in some predominantly black contests for committee men and the legislature in the primary. That Cook County's population does not break down like the city's, or that there are some internal community problems of crime, education, and respect that need to be tackled, and to discuss them is not anti-black. But curses on any outsider who would dare say Chicago has a race problem. What race problem?
May 20th, 1984. Confirmation, Mischief of Little Men.
The confirmation hearings of city appointees are becoming a modern-day Inquisition. The City Council Rules Committee vote against Alderman Designate Dorothy Tillman last week means the people of the Third Ward soon will begin their second year without representation. Former Alderman Tyrone Kenner was convicted of bribery and mail fraud last June. Tillman was nominated in December and has been grilled and delayed ever since.
While she has waited, none too patiently, a black businessman named Edward Gardner of Soft Sheen Products is voluntarily paying her $26,000 aldermanic salary and ward office rent that was in the arrears. A problem she might not have had if she were a full-fledged alderman with a budget. That should be some indication of the black community's faith in her. In March, she won the ward committeeman race with 61% of the vote, which probably is a bigger mandate from her constituents than most of the aldermen opposing her received. A galvanizing activist and organizer, Tillman surely knows her constituents better than most aldermen know theirs. But the only evidence against her has been the bruised feelings of Alderman Bernard Stone, 50th, who claims she called him a bad name during her school protest days. Poor Bernie. And then there is Cultural Affairs appointee Fred Fine, 70, who is being baited about his Communist Party membership in the 1950s. The ghost of Joe McCarthy doesn't belong in hearings on the arts. And on it goes. There are so many appointees to city departments and boards and commissions waiting now that they'll have to take a number to be served. No doubt the council majority is hoping the wait will span Mayor Washington's term in office. An administration spokesman said that at last count, these appointments were on hold. Board of Health, Dr. Quinn Young, Department of Purchasing. William Spicer, Board of Municipal Investigations, Raleigh Mathis, Chicago Park District, Dr. Margaret Burroughs, and Walter Nesch. And the City College's Board of Trustees, Dr. Shirley Buttrick, Carmen Riviera Martinez, Tommy Briscoe, Ronald Griswinski, Reverend Albert Sampson, and Reverend Jeremiah A. Wright, Jr. Also, the Chicago Police Board, Robert Hollick, Nancy Jefferson, Norval Morris, David Riviera, and Ari Pinnick. Personal Board, Warren Bankin, Chicago Public Library Board, 2 confirmed but 3 remain, Carlo Rodriguez, Dorothy McConner, Dr. Connett Russell, Chicago Regional Port Authority, Garland Geis, Plan Commission, Walter Clark, Marshall Hollop, and Lorena Esperanza McNeely, Chicago Board of Education, Dr. Frank Gardner, and Attorney Joyce Moran, Cable Commission, Arnett Hubbard, Lilia Delgado, Robert Mann, Mark Jones. The school board and cable panel have had hearings. And last but hardly least is the Public Building Commission. A certain person by the name of Harold Washington has not been afforded the respect of past mayors in getting an automatic seat on the panel that oversees all the public buildings in his own domain. The Rules Committee that is trying to frustrate Tillman has had its hands in this one since October. No one is suggesting that every name submitted be approved. There will be legitimate questions of competence or conflict of interest, though more than likely the questions will be invented. To be fair, a few of the delays are in committees headed by Washington allies, and some appointments were quite recent. But the council's majority's skullduggery is the issue. Meanwhile, the business of some boards is going on with hacks whose terms expired years ago, and there are charges that the shenanigans go beyond delaying hearings. Many sitting appointees with expired terms have loyalties to the 29 majority bloc aldermen and allegedly are being instructed to miss meetings so there will be no quorum. The mischief on confirmations offers a fine lesson in what a little power can do to little men. May 27, 1984, trifling with the city's stability. Politics, my eye. The legal maneuvering last week to dethrone the mayor was not just a sample of Chicago's intriguing mode of government. The move by Alderman Edward Burke, 14th, was pure provocation, a laboratory specimen of racism. When Burke filed a lawsuit alleging the mayor was not the mayor, he was inciting more than a council floor fight. The standing and stability of the city of Chicago should not be trifled with. The mayor apparently did not file his financial disclosure statement until last week. The deadline was April 30th. The required forms also were signed by his secretary, not him. Burke gleefully proclaimed the mayor had forfeited his job by state law because of these errors. The administration said it was a snafu. Snafu or not, the mayor should have had the statement in.
If not on the dot, certainly sooner than 3 weeks past the deadline. But the response to this laxity should have been a slap on the wrist from some authority other than Burke. It did not have to become a slap in the face of the mayor and the black community. Harold Washington surely recognizes after a year of experience with the council majority that if his suit coat is missing a button, the 29 will twist that to his detriment. Unfortunately, his response is going to have to be owning a lot of buttons and thread. In government, that translates into having an impenetrable line of defense, a solid plan, a quick idea, an airtight legal argument, a wily staff, an unimpeachable spokesperson or two, a direct communication link to all communities, a strategist who can anticipate the unthinkable, a capable council diplomat, a capable council cutthroat, and at least one detailed person to ensure against these minor snafus that become major imbroglios. The mayor does not have all of these, sometimes because of the opposition's obstructionism. For example, the loss of an advocacy department of neighborhoods and the budget battle serve some new links with communities. But oftentimes, the mayor's own stubbornness has foiled him. His allies complain that he does not seek their counsel. He has, especially in recent weeks, responded affirmatively to criticism that he temper his remarks, reach out to business and fearful neighborhoods, and just run the city as best he can with these mad dogs nipping at his heels. Yet, the 29 has scoffed at such appeals, shamelessly speeding ahead with their plunder of what is left of the city's reputation and goodwill. It's tough to be magnanimous in the face of bared fangs, but the mayor will have to try. Alderman Edward Verdoliak, 10th, is more likely to cry sic'em than yank the leashes anytime soon. All the hugging and talk of Democratic unity is so much fodderal, but there is a city to be managed, and it will take the mayor and 50 aldermen to do it. The mayor will never change the hardcore obstructionists, who are most of the 29. These are white men of the old order politically and socially, who have yet to recognize Washington as a human being, a black, a man, or the mayor. But magnanimity might work on a few of the more thinking members who ought to be downright embarrassed. The wonder in all this is, where are the voters in the wards of the 29? Maybe they would destroy the city to save it. No one is asking them to let the mayor live next door, but they surely see the viciousness in the assaults on the mayor's command and in the opposition to Dorothy Tillman, who is being toyed with on her third ward aldermanic nomination. She was another intended victim of the council chaos last week. Discussions on the World's Fair Community Development Block Grants and other city business were just in the way of Burke's sniping. Other cities with black mayors function, even flourish. To those who intimate that Washington is not like those other good little colorless and inoffensive black mayors, take note that the bare knuckles brawling that resurfaced in the council proves our elected representatives are unlike any other cities.
Context too. Of white supremacy, and we will pick up. We're starting a whole new section. I was going to let it go a little bit further, but since we're picking up the new section is crime and punishment, I thought it would be apropos to stop there. So we're going to the second audio segment once we finish our discussion. If you have commentary that you would like to share based on what you've heard thus far, feel free to chime in. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. press star 6 if you would like to participate. Ms. McLean has a pretty expansive vocabulary, I will say. Skullduggery. I picked up quite a few new words as we've been reading along. Skullduggery, antediluvian, even though she was quoting from Mayor Washington at the time. The number again, 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone and you still want to participate, feel free. You can use the free VOPE line. It should be linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tinyty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put that address in, click the link on the left side of the page. It says free VOPE line. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line is a drop down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us, and it is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You will see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do so, you will hear an audio prompt to press the number 1. When you do that, I'll see your hand on the screen. We will add you to the line and look forward to hearing your commentary. All the folks who chimed in who have a hand up should be with us. Feel free to chime in. I think that should be Mr. Demery for our narrator, caller in Michigan, Roz, Thomas in New York, person from a blocked number. Actually, we have 2 people from a blocked number. All of you should be with us. It's enough folks. I'll just open the lines up and feel free to chime in if you have commentary.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Ford. Good to hear from you again.
All righty. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to the other callers. If I've learned anything from this book, I've learned that our mental health is very important and that counter-racism is very stressful, and sometimes we have to take a break. That's what I've been doing the last couple of weeks, but I feel refreshed. So this book concerning Harold Washington, one question you ask is, why would someone leave Capitol Hill? He was a House of Representatives member, you know, up until the time that he became mayor of Chicago. Leave Capitol Hill to become the mayor of Chicago, unless it was a strong motivation to make a difference, to help his people. And Chicago, one city that was in desperate need of some assistance. I can respect the man's legacy. And they mentioned the $277 proposed $1 million revitalization of the naval pier. But, you know, they would have much money for that, but then the $300 million that was needed for a new hospital, Cook County Hospital, the money just wasn't there. Cook County Hospital, I think she did a pretty good job of summing up the situation at the hospital where over 3,000 blacks die every year. And patient dumping, whereas if you have no money, you know, welfare, whatever, and you are in need of medical care, then the ambulance was instructed to drop you off if you were non-white, I assume, at County Hospital, and they were overrun. She mentioned the shoddy professionalism at the hospital, but, you know, failed to note that with all that dumping going on and all the violence in Chicago, then the emergency room was probably nonstop at Cook County. The housing authority, you know, she said some negative things about Renault Robinson and those elevators, but then you have Charles Schwabel, a real estate millionaire that was advisor to three mayors, but hope I'm not getting these guys mixed up, but I believe he was a slumlord, and he had some properties down on Skid Row and also on the west side. And, you know, it's, I started looking at some of these characters, and the aldermen that are giving Mayor Washington the blues, some of these people are still alive now, you know, and it seems that these white politicians, regardless of the stress, seem to live on into their late 70s, early 80s. Jane Byer is dead. She died at 81. But black officials seem to die much earlier. And we all know that Harold Washington died in 87 of a heart attack. And then, you know, it was a slight mention of Lou Palmer. I think he should be mentioned because when he got to Chicago, he had a PhD in journalism. He was called the Panther with a Pen. And like Tepin, his people was one of the first to question the FBI's raid on black Panthers, Fred Hampton and Clark. But this Charles Schwabel ran the housing, Chicago Housing Authority for over 20 years. And then Renault, the black guy, Renault, let's see, what was his name? Renault Robinson, you know, comes in and they start ribbing him about the elevators. Well, the guy's been there 20 years. They were already spending over $10 million in maintenance on these housing units, and nothing was getting better. They even had a police station at some of these housing units so that they could create the situation, blacks living on top of each other with no hope, and cause the violence among each other, and then just enter them right into the prison industrial system right there at the housing complex. She talked about Clarence McLean, you know, and when she started talking about some of these people, it sounded a little anti-black, because Clarence McLean was caught up in the FBI sting operation, Operation Incubator. You know, so they lay traps for you. They create these records, criminal records for you, and then they come back to bite you later on. So I would say on page 108, the last sentence, talking about the theory is ultimately a clash of two separate and unequal cultures, finally meeting head on as equals. And unfortunately, the collision is in the very public halls of government. I don't understand that because two separate and unequal cultures meeting head on as equals, that's not true. That's an incorrect statement. And I'll just say that, taken from the Godfather movie, a lawyer can steal more money with a briefcase than 1,000 men with guns and masks. Don Corleone, the Godfather. I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus, for taking the call.
Yes, sir. Other folks have commentary they would like to share?
Can I be heard?
Oh, go ahead, Thomas. I'll go after you.
Yeah, I'm going to be very quick, Ross. Thank you. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Mr. Demery, very quickly, man, I would say that this was pretty unbelievable if I hadn't experienced the last 7 years and saw how they did Obama. And it's like, wow, I think they took the playbook right out of Chicago, what they did on Capitol Hill here. And we had a Reverend Wright mentioned. He was on one of the committees, I think, that the mayor had assumed. Sounds a lot like, you know, what they're doing with the current justice. They're not going to put them in until they get the person they want in the White House. So this will be interesting. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys, to Mr. Dermy Four, Thomas in New York, the narrator in Michigan. Thank you so much for your great reading of the text, and to all the callers and listeners. I was just wanted to touch a little bit on something that Mr. Dermy just spoke about when he discussed that last line where she talked about two separate unequal cultures finally meeting head on as equals. That right there, that brief line really depicts like how mental illness manifests itself, because two things cannot be separate and unequal and then meet as equals. It just doesn't happen. It's just something where you can kind of see that she's not necessarily computing things in a way that makes sense. And then it's just, I guess, her thought pattern in that moment. It's the way she is discussing it. So that was just one thing I wanted to touch on, just because it really just shows how a lack of understanding of the system of white supremacy can create these imbalances that manifest in sometimes the way we express ourselves in certain instances. One thing I thought about was, no wonder why he died so young. They literally, racism, white supremacy, this man to death. And I'll mirror what Thomas in New York said. I believe that the blueprint for what they have done and continue to do to President Obama, they literally got from what happened to Harold Washington. And I just feel for him because, I had a couple experiences this week. I'll talk about tomorrow, workplace racism. But the intricacies and the networking, I mean, like on the spot networking that white people do and did in this text, as far as how the many different ways she described how they would just gang up on and tag team Harold Washington, was just flabbergasting. And the way that they function, I really think when I came up with the term white supremacist superorganism, I believe just the coordinated psychological and public torture of this man really speaks to them functioning as just that, a white supremacist superorganism, all white people. There was a term that she used when she talked about the lakefront situation where they wanted to build the multimillion dollar shopping center on the lakefront. She said the term she used was white elephant. And the reason why that stands out to me is because it is the only term that I've come across thus far outside of 2000 Seasons by Ayikwe Arma, where the term white is not considered positive. And the first time I came across the term white elephant was in a documentary about the Olympics and how many countries were rejecting the Olympics due to the fact that they build these multi-million-dollar stadiums across their countries to accommodate for the Olympics, stealing massive millions of dollars from the people and impoverishing them to build these stadiums, and then after the Olympics are over, the stadiums get no use. So they sit there, they're giant spaces, state-of-the-art spaces that get no use whatsoever, and they started using the term white elephant. And they went around the world to all the different locations, I believe, in, like, the last 20 years that they had the Olympics and showed, like, the remnants of these quote-unquote white elephants. And in Brazil, I heard that they were planning to potentially turn some of these stadiums into housing developments for people in the favelas. I don't know how that's going to come to fruition, but that was something I heard them tossing around. So that term white elephant, I just wanted to touch on that briefly. Also, where is it? I found it interesting on page 114, she said briefly in Crimes Against Free Expression, I believe she's talking about President Reagan, she said, he and his administration have crept up on free expression, intent on strangling it. Their actions are regressive and dangerous, and though they can't see it, un-American. The free flow of opinion in this nation is this nation's very reason for being. It has worked amazingly well for 200 years, but Reagan would quash it. And again, it just shows, again, a serious lack of understanding of the system of white supremacy and her belief in white people. Just for her to be a black female using the term un-American when there is no such thing as free expression, and they're not strangling anything that they haven't strangled from the origins of this country, and anything that was built in this country or any sort of freedom that she's discussing is freedom for white people. This has absolutely nothing to do with people of African descent in this country or non-white people whatsoever. So it just really shows that, when she said that it worked amazingly well for more than 200 years, and we can go through the myriad of wars and Ben Tillman's smashing people with canes and all the other incidences to prove that it's never worked, and there was no such thing as free expression in this country. So I just found that just like a really sad misreading of the way white supremacy works. And then on the following page, she was describing, she was talking about terrorism. She said, obviously all nations hope to thwart or punish terrorists. The consistent and frightening signs from this administration are that an active defense may be applied, or rather unleashed domestically, after years of trying to reverse the abuses of infiltration during the protest movements of the 1960s. The term is being used previously applied to nuclear war strategy. What was the 1969 raid on the Black Panthers on the West Side but a preemptive action? But the missive on terrorism is just part of a pattern that reveals the administration's alarmist and paranoid tendencies. Again, alarmist and paranoid, for me, translates as racist white supremacist. The language that she's using to discuss terrorism and including the Black Panthers' preemptive action that was done on the in the raid on the Black Panthers speaks to exactly the climate that we're living in now, and how now thug is the new term for nigga. Muslims are now the new niggas as well. It literally sounds like what we're living in is a ramped up version of exactly what she's describing right now. What she's describing was happening then. We're living it now, but in a more ramped up state. So I found that very telling as well. And then, oh, yes, the section where Harold Washington was on the show with Eddie Vrdoljak, I found this to be a treatise in the way white people psychologically terrorized this man. The reason why was in the area on 117 where Vrdoljak said, "That's past gone. I want your viewers to know that I offered to meet with the mayor no less than 433 times in just the last week. And even though I said I'm not going to negotiate in the media, I got 433 stories about my extending the olive branch and turning over a new leaf and becoming nice Eddie. Tonight is my big chance to show my new image, and you have seated me from my worst profile." Washington says, "The media never understand me or my culture. I made the offer first and a total of 527 times, but the funky media only reported it 5 times. Wiseman says, "Mr. Mayor, what do you mean when you use the term funky?" Washington says, "See, you're what I mean. You don't understand me." Wiseman says, "Let's turn to another subject." And Vrdoljak jumps up from the table, pointing his finger at Washington. "He kicked me. He kicked me. Did you get that on camera? The mayor of the city of Chicago kicked me on the shins right here on air." And Washington lunges across the table. "Hey, bub, don't muss my bulletproof vest," Vrdoljak says. And then it goes on. He says, Washington says, "I knew this was going to happen. I should never have agreed to this. You scurrilous, spurious, antediluvian, doo-doo, funky lowlife. Wiseman ever composed. Speaking of low, we're just about at the end of time. We'd like to thank our guest, Mayor Hal Washington, and Alderman Edward Vodoliak for their joint appearance. Hey, no fighting on the tabletop. Good night." I found this to be so telling because just this reading shows how the media and this particular person, Wiseman, was an agent provocateur, and he was also partnered up with Vodoliak in the way that this situation played out. It also shows that Harold Washington had some sort of reservations about doing the program, and obviously he felt that he should have taken his own advice and not appeared on the program. And then Vodoliak, when Wiseman says to the mayor, "Just what do you mean when you use the term funky? It's the way that white people ask you questions and whenever they feel offended." I think we talked about this last week. Whenever they, when you say something, that they take offense to it almost in a collective manner. And when he asked him about that, it's the way that white people ply you for further information so that they can use it against you. So you might be having what you think is a regular conversation, and it's a seemingly innocuous question, "What do you mean by the term funky?" And then what they do is they go for the jugular once you get into that lane with that particular person. And then for Vodoliak, when he jumps up and says, "He kicked me," it's creating an atmosphere of him being the violent black male. And it was just, I found it very telling about the way white people function and the way that they use our own decision making against us and put us in positions where they can checkmate us. And it does a ton of psychological damage specifically to him because he died so young. And it all made sense to me as to the reason why. And then the last thing was on the page 122. I found that when Mrs. McLean was talking, she was writing, she said, "The mayor will never change the hardcore obstructionists and who were most of the 29. These white men are of the old order politically and socially who have yet to recognize Washington as a human being, a black man, or the mayor. But magnanimity might work on a few of the more thinking members who ought to be downright embarrassed." And when she used the term obstructionist, hardcore obstructionist, she just means hardcore racist white supremacist. And she's describing the psychology, like they don't, the same way that they wrote us as three-fifths of human beings in the Constitution is the same way they look at us today. And like I said, the same white people that we walk around every day are the same white people that were here 500 years ago committing genocide against our ancestors. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Before we get our other callers, I did just want to point out that exchange with Mayor Washington and Mr. Vodoliak, that was a satire, so that was not something that actually happened. That was just a satire where she made up this exchange that is not based on
facts. Oh, thank you.
Any of the other folks who dialed in who had commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
You can go ahead.
Well, I guess we will get our narrator first.
Okay, I'll be brief because a lot of the statements I was going to make has already been stated. Good evening, Gus, and to the callers and listeners. I definitely made notation about the Cook County House article and the fact that just from what I've seen, how every major city, you know, has that one or two hellhole hospital for, you know, poor people. And I just remember growing up, I suffered asthma as a child, and I was all too familiar with that hellhole hospital during a time when, you know, we had like state-funded insurance. And I remember just how much I hated going to the hospitals, getting these breathing treatments, and just how long it took. It just seemed like, you know, it was just, they just had no regard for us at that time. And then I remember when my mother, she had got a new job and we got this, you know, this better insurance. I remember just being just in total awe when, you know, we switched doctors and we started going the hospital out in the suburbs. And I remember just my sister and I, we would, you know, want to get sick, so to speak, to go to the hospital because of the treatment that we received. So when she was talking about Cook County Hospital and just the hellhole conditions, it just reminded me of my childhood. And even the nursing facilities. My sister, she's a caregiver, and you know, just the difference in the nursing facilities for the elderly. So that article really stuck out to me. Also on page 118, she used the term ethnic whites, and I was not clear at all what she meant by that term. Could probably shed some light on what she possibly meant. I just did not understand that. And Gus, like you said, her vocabulary is definitely expansive. As I was reading the, you know, the articles this week, I definitely had, you know, just to look up so many words I had never actually heard before, and just, you know, pretty, it was just the, you know, just the word choices that she chose. But when this ethnic white, clear what she meant by that, and I will mute my line.
Sure. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers.
Howdy,
yeah,
Karma.
I mean, how are you? Oh, it's Karma. Hi, everyone. I will have to say her vocabulary is awesome. She is just amazing. I'm like, so that's how you end it? No, so that's what that word is. So I was really happy about that. I have new words, new $2 words. So, just what the reader was saying, I have my own childhood memories of Cook County Hospital, and I know you told you about my sister dying there, and I don't think I even mentioned I had 25 stitches in my thumb, the most innervated area of your body, without any kind of local anesthesia. I remember each stitch. But my thumb works, so I guess the alternative to that, since you didn't have any insurance at all at first, was no thumb. So, I remember Cook County Hospital. I remember I'm surprised it's still there. It's like, wow. So, but they would like to get rid of it because I guess since I do have my thumbs, that means if we can get rid of all of the hospitals for the poor people, then maybe they will die a little bit faster. Get rid of the schools and get rid of the hospitals, get that genocide going and get these people out of here. My ears perked up when I heard them mention that they were planning on bringing that World's Fair to Chicago, because that's another tool of genocide. What you do is before Mayor Washington came in, they were saying, well, you know, we're starting to have urban blight and now it's turning into a rust belt and we need to innovate the city. Hey, let's have a World's Fair. And I'm wondering if he agreed to do that, and then when he got in there realized exactly, you know, well, maybe he knew before what the World's Fair is. It's just a bunch of people lose so that white people can spin around and look at non-white people in what they call their native environment. And it started all as a part of the anthropology movement in Eastern Europe, and it was absolutely nothing but quintessential racism. The World Fair is nothing but racism. That is the whole purpose of the World Fair. But, and it also serves to get rid of people. And it was the same thing with President Obama. It reminded me, President Obama got elected. First thing he did was roll on over and say, hey, you guys, you can come and put the Olympics here in Chicago, another tool for urban blight. Let's get rid of these people. Here's another way we can get them out of their city, and it'll be so much the better. So I think that Mayor Washington got caught up in that too when they tried to put the World's Fair in Chicago, just like President Obama and Mrs. Obama got caught up with the Olympics coming to Chicago, which would have been awful. Oh, yeah, yeah. When she was talking about the what did she call them, the pack of 29 or whatever. And then she was saying all of these things that Mayor Washington would have had to do. He couldn't have lost a button. He would have had to have a perpetual supply of buttons and thread, and he would have had to have all kinds of advisors, and this is what he needs. He needs a prescient person all over him so that they can see the future, divine what's coming. And I'm like, I think that's probably what killed him. I just think that the only way, even if you can't have, even if at this point, you know, being politically active with these people is not, you know, you're going to have success or survival. But if you actually pay attention to all of that yapping and screaming and nitpicking and being, if you paid attention to that, that's what kills you. I mean, I just think that when he kind of mellowed out and started taking other people's advice, which is what they kept telling him, oh, you know, you don't seek our counsel. I think that him doing that at the beginning of his second term is exactly what killed him. And he was just doing his own thing, being reasonable, being rational, just doing the intelligent thing. He was surviving. But the minute he said, okay, I'll be a little bit more expansive, I'll seek their counsel, and I'm sure that that's what killed him. So anyway, I think that they should be ignored. If you get into a position like that, you should ignore them as well as you are able to ignore them. Don't seek their counsel. Don't work with them. Do the thing that's the intelligent thing. And I think that you'll survive a little bit longer. I mean, those are my impressions.
Anyone who had a hand up that we have not heard from? Assuming we got all the folks who have a hand up for the time being, if anybody that we have not heard from who has a hand up, or anyone that we haven't heard from, period, even if you don't have a hand up, you should get your hand up now. That way we'll get you in before we get to the second audio segment. Some of the quick tidbits. Notes I had taken, good commentary from everyone. The first essay, Unequal Cultures, Unsavory Past, I thought you all already made great observations about her kind of concluding point about quote-unquote equal cultures finally meeting head. Well, I'll read it the exact way she has it. This furor is ultimately a clash of two separate and unequal cultures finally meeting head-on as equals. Nothing could be further from the truth in the system of white supremacy, but it just seems like most of what she talks about here might be summed up as, I guess, what they call respectability politics. It seems like that popped up quite a few times in this essay, where she's talking about the vetting process for different appointments for Harold Washington once he became mayor, and going back and looking through people's backgrounds and saying, oh man, you know, you stole something when you were 12, and various other offenses, and saying whether or not some of these people, maybe they shouldn't be appointed because they have a criminal background. I did think she made some great points in talking about the difference in terms of how white people are treated if they have any sort of criminal record versus black people, and even the white supremacy that produces, that mandates that black people have more frequent contact with enforcement officials and are treated way worse by the criminal, what they call criminal justice system, whereas white people just are not charged, are not arrested. I mean, there are so many examples of that. I think former agent Mr. Fogg, where he talked about the war on drugs, where he was told by his white supervisors that we're not going to enforce any of these policies in white areas. This is specifically for the Negros. But it just seems like even within all of that, there still seem to be some sort of, you know, hey, maybe some of these people shouldn't have these positions. Maybe some of these people are no good and, you know, shouldn't be offered this opportunity to have these sort of posts. I mean, just in the system of white supremacy, there are so many white deviants, criminals, all types of scoundrels who get all kinds of jobs, all kinds of positions. And there's no brouhaha about, oh my gosh, they can't have this job, they did this when they were a child, or they did this last week, where that just doesn't happen. I mean, there are tons of these. Jerry Sandusky at Penn State, where he was eventually convicted, but there had been charges for years that he was doing inappropriate sexual conduct, raping children, and nothing was done. They didn't even file any charges. This went on for years, decades up there. And there's so many other examples, which just, for me, it's difficult to even begin any sort of comparison and talking about the black person shouldn't be there, or maybe they don't deserve this post and that sort of thing. Just the biggest criminals on the planet are whites, racist, white supremacists. The next essay. Let's see, she's talking about Harold Washington. I also thought that there, and it seems like it goes on quite a bit, where she talks about Harold Washington, where it's making an assessment of how he's responding to these ongoing and ceaseless attacks. I think I brought this up last week, where it seems like two things. I think number one, her attempting, hey, I'm a journalist and I'm a black female, so I know I'm, you know, being watched, I'm being edited by whites. I got to make it seem like I'm being even-handed, as they say. I got to make it seem like I'm being balanced, as they say. So I can't just come out and criticize whites and make it seem like they are most to blame. I got to try and make it seem even that I'm, you know, calling out, I'm fault-finding equally on both parts. It seems like there's quite a bit of that over the chunk of the book that we have read thus far. And she'll fault-find with the white people, and then she'll come back and she'll do that for Harold Washington. And just to me, the problem with I see in that is that if whites are most to blame, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, Harold Washington is being mistreated. He is responding to racism. We can't make this, and we will find fault. We will assign blame equally to both sides, because that is not what is happening. He is being attacked by a gang. That's how I described the Verdoliak 29. This is a gang. This is in the same vein as Al Capone, some of, you know, Chicago's greatest gangland activity, where they just say, hey, this is our mandate. We're going to block whatever this nigga mayor tries to do. We're going to block budget attempts, appointment attempts, anything he tries to do. We're going after it to see if we can mess him up and shame him. And the whole time that, you know, I think you all have pointed this out, where have I heard this before? This seems eerily reminiscent. Black person gets elected, whites immediately go about making this person fail. We want to see this person in total ruin, block anything this person does, even file frivolous lawsuits to see if we get this person to lose their elected position. It just seems so familiar. The next post, I think you all already talked about that. In fact, that Olive Branch piece, because it was a satire, that, again, because this is war, racism, white supremacy being war, it was kind of strange. Even though, you know, I could see elements of humor in the piece, just I tend not to talk about racism as a laughing, joking manner, but I definitely see some elements of humor in that satirical piece. The piece where she wrote about, is Navy Pier up Swibel's sleeve? Even there, where Mayor Washington, he was attempting to have negotiations and even requesting greater time to explore, would this be something financially feasible? And this might be a good project for Chicago to invest in. Let's thwart that. When other white people, when the former mayor Jane Byrne, when she had attempted to look at different projects, any sort of renewal, business opportunities, fine, no problem, let's go ahead. This nigger, Mayor Washington, comes in to try to do the same thing. No way. We're not doing it. We're not even going to allow you to have extra time to investigate, to see if this might be something worthwhile to investigate, which just, in my view, again, this is gang activity. This is not politics as normal. This is racism, white supremacy. You just have a white gang that's going about mistreating a black person that you all have rightly pointed out. This obstruction, in my view, led to the death of Harold Washington, untimely death of Harold Washington, in the same vein as the Anita McLean and even Max Robinson, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program. The next essay, the article on Cook County Hospital, Hope for the Poor, I thought she did just a great job in really lots and lots of details. Her own personal experience with this hospital and a lot of the other black people in the Chicago area. It reminded me when we did our reading on New Orleans. I think there was Baptist Hospital. I think in Atlanta it would be Grady. I think, as our narrator pointed out, that they have a lot of these institutions, particularly in major cities where they have a high population of black people. It'll be one dumping ground hellhole hospital. We can pile all of them. It reminded me a book that we did before, Rebecca Skloot, Henrietta Lacks, the hospital where she went in Johns Hopkins in Baltimore seemed to be kind of the same type of thing. Institutions that tend to be ripe for the exploitation of black people, and even some of that came through what we heard this week, I think. Also, it even reminded me contemporary, they got the Obama Library last year. They got that award, I guess, whatever you would like to call it. A lot of black people there were saying, we do not need a library, we need a hospital on the south side of Chicago, not a library that might just be another tool for taking land from black people. They still have dire medical and health needs in that area. The next piece, and we all sync together, I think you all already touched on just the way that she talks about racism and not understanding it. I think that that probably had a lot to do with her depression, her lack of mental health. When she says, see if I can pick out some of the really good portions from this piece here. Yeah, and we all sync together when she says, what race problem? There wouldn't be any race problem. Every side insists if those people would just do right or go away or try togetherness. Integration won't have a chance here before it's buried, and few will even lament it. It doesn't matter now which side started it or is keeping it up, for when it is finished, everyone will sink together. I think I read that section last week where it suggested that Leonida McLean attempted to be quote-unquote raceless, that is, presenting herself, I'm just here, I'm not a representative for black people, I'm just here trying to do my job, and I'm going to be quote-unquote even-handed about all of this, and slowly realizing, whoa, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, it doesn't matter if I try to insist that I'm not going to really play up the fact or try to be a super... I'm a black person. You're going to recognize me as a black person. We're going to talk about racism, blah, blah, blah. I'm just trying to be even-handed that seeing everything unfold with this mayoral campaign, how Harold Washington was treated, that it made it very clear to her, this is a system of racism, white supremacy, and white people are going to treat me and all of the blacks, as she kept saying in the piece on how Chicago taught her to hate whites. It just made it very clear what this was all about, and it didn't really matter how she presented herself, what she tried, if she tried to show whites, you know, whatever position she tried to take in terms of her presentation to white people, even the white people that she thought were good or what have you. It seems, at least even in the title of that, we all sing together this notion of trying to make this work, quote unquote integration, whatever that means, that we're all in this together. We can try. Even the suggestion, it doesn't matter who started it, as though, again, I think I've said that every time that we've had a report, some sort of suggestion that this is an equal spat, that black people and white people are just having kind of a little neighborhood quarrel, when that's not what it is at all. This is total white terrorism, and just not having that clearly presented on a weekly basis. Some of the other in that same essay, we will all sing together. I think that was Thomas in New York who called that out. Reverend Jeremiah Wright, he was one of the people, they were blocking his appointment, which again, to my view, goes to show that this is not a spat between equals, that whites, clearly, you've got a gang that's just going about the work, that we're just going to block and obstruct everything that Mayor Washington tries to do. And again, the similarities, Reverend Jeremiah Wright comes up. Again, when a black person wins a political office and white people are upset, Jeremiah Wright again has to be what they call thrown under the bus. There's no way we want to see this black person getting any sort of political appointment or any type of title here in the city of Chicago. And again, even in that essay, there seemed to be some more of this respectability politics where it's kind of chiding Mayor Washington for how he's responding to all of this, where she says the majority bloc will stand firm against allowing Mayor Washington to buy even a new push broom for the next 3 years, so that when he tries to point to his accomplishments, they can gloat that he has been ineffective. The mayor would be rather combative than mayoral and give the obstreperousness of the opposition. It is hard to blame him, but
good government will indeed be good politics if he gets his staff agenda together. And again, it's just one of those things, in my view, where it is it's very difficult to chide or even try to find any faults with how someone is responding to being terrorized. When you have, I mean, again, that's all I can continue to say. This is a gang where you have 29, probably all white people, who have just dedicated their time and energy and what they're going to do on their job to making you fail. That is gang activity on the part of racists, coordinated, in my opinion. The piece where she talks about the Black Panthers, I thought that was important just, again, because the role of Chicago Tribune. This was not just one person, and I wouldn't even call this a preemptive act against a group that they classified as terrorists. This is just murder to go out and kill Fred Hampton while he was in bed next to his pregnant wife. They fired me just tons of rounds with everything that happened in this case. And the Chicago Tribune, the white-dominated media, they participated in practicing racism and justifying all this, as I brought up last week, her very same Chicago Tribune that she was writing for at the time. I guess the last one that I'll get in, I thought this was important. And one other quick point, the city of Chicago has had exactly two mayors since Harold Washington. Now, they did have a special appointee to finish out Mr. Washington's term after his death, who was also a black male, but after that, they have had exactly two mayors, and it's been 25 years since Harold Washington's term ended, or the appointee who finished out his term. It's been about 25 years. They've had two mayors, Richard M. Daley and Rahm Emanuel, in that time. That, in and of itself, I think, is profound. It speaks volume to the type of politics that, and how they operate in the city of Chicago. At any rate, the final two points I wanted to make sure I got in, where she talks about trifling with the city's stability. Number one, I thought it was really important because that piece was written days, literally, before her suicide. It was May 27th, 1984, and she committed suicide on Memorial Day in 1984. But in that piece where she says, she starts it off where she says, a laboratory specimen of racism and what she saw. And I mean, they've got all these cute terms, the Verdoliak 29, the Eddies, when they're talking about Alderman Edward Burke, and then Edward Verdoliak when they are describing this gang activity to obstruct the elected Mayor Harold Washington, where she describes this, a laboratory specimen of racism. In my view, it seems like as she got closer to her suicide, and I would say particularly everything forward from the How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites, it seems very, very clear that it was becoming inescapable to her what it means to be white, what they were doing, how they were treating Harold Washington, and how this was even going beyond just him as the mayor into to how blacks in Chicago in total were being talked about and treated, even herself. She talks a lot about that in the How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites piece, but it just seems very, very clear, and I strongly suspect that that had a lot to do with the deterioration in her mental health. Seeing this and it just becoming something that she just, you know, could not hide. It was right in her face what whites were doing in terms of obstructing Harold Washington, where she's talking about these appointments and even just the whole title and what she's bringing out in this piece here. We will totally ruin the entire city of Chicago if that allows us to destroy Harold Washington. And again, we have heard this before, where you've got whites basically with the same type of rhetoric. I think Dr. Welsing used to always call out Rush Limbaugh and these other whites saying that they want the country to fail. If that means President Obama is in ruin, great. Don't care. We will sabotage everything. I think even Michael Bradley, when he was on the program back in 2009, where he said that if whites cannot dominate the planet, we will destroy it. Where you see that same sort of racist pathological ethos. If it can't be white domination, if it's got to be a black person in charge and doing well, ugh, everything needs to fail. It doesn't matter what gets messed up, everything needs to fail. We cannot have that ever for any reason. Yeah, and even within that, I still felt like I saw a little bit more of the respectability politics and scrutinizing how we respond to all of this terrorism. When she says, speaking of Harold Washington,
He has, especially in recent weeks, responded affirmatively to criticism that he tempered his remarks, reach out to business and fearful neighborhoods, and just run the city as best he can with these mad dogs nipping at his heels. Yet the 29 have scoffed at such appeals, shamelessly speeding ahead with their plunder of what is left of the city's reputation and goodwill. I think it's there, but I think even there she starts to temper these criticisms and giving any sort of presentation that maybe both sides have some blame in all of these racial politics and hostility that's going on. Maybe both sides can do a little bit better. It seems like it starts to be a bit more reflective of the truthful power dynamics of white people. They are most to blame. They are terrorizing Harold Washington and black people at large, and they are most responsible to all of this. And, you know, even if Harold Washington is, you know, be whatever he's doing, he's responding to terrorism. I can totally understand someone being upset and just, hey, look at what this gang, Berdoliak and the Eddies, look at what they're doing in terms of just trying to totally destroy his administration. I will pause there. Do we have any other folks who had comments that they want to make sure they got in before we get to the second audio segment? If you heard anything that is not clear, or if you have questions. I think our narrator, her question about quote-unquote white ethnics, I think it's in the Word Guide. Mr. Fuller encourages not using the term ethnics. And I think she's referring to groups that would be called like Polish whites, quote-unquote, or other groups like that. I think Chicago, they have a significant population of quote-unquote Polish or Irish. These different groups, these are white people. They might say, well, hey, my great-grandparents, or I have an uncle who was, you know, from Ireland or Germany or wherever they happen to be on the planet. At the end of the day, these are folks that are still classified, function as white, probably race soldiers. But I think that's what she means when she says, quote unquote, ethnic whites. Do we have anybody who we have not heard from who had questions, commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you sounded like you was the voice was breaking up, the connection. I don't know if everybody else can hear that, but anyway, I just wanted to my report on the first reading with the history of racism and supremacy. Hello.
Oh, we can hear you. I can hear you. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. With the history of racism and white supremacy in Chicago, Mr. Washington already being a veteran politician, from my past studies, I always thought that he had some health issues coming into the situation. But I'm saying that to say that with all the corruption the area that's called Chicago is known for. I remember Miss Pam talking about it almost every time she comes on. And I visited Chicago myself on several occasions. Also, Chicago has some of the biggest public housing they had at that time. They've torn them down, but they had some of the largest public housing project areas in the world, literally in the world, that goes on for miles, and these tall, high buildings where all of these non-white black people who are suffering, and him coming into that situation is what I'm saying, is only going to, if somebody has some kind of health problems, it definitely is going to make it a lot worse in that process. With the idea of white people ganging up and coming directly against anything he tries to initiate, which I know he did, attempted to do, that would measure some sort of progress with people who need the most help. And in that case, of course, it would be non-white black people. And speaking about hospitals, like Cook County Hospital, as I've heard some of the callers mention, that particular type of hospital is almost everywhere where there are large areas of non-white people at. About the only thing that can be considered to be good about them, me being, you know, a retired emergency medical professional, is trauma. because they constantly get trauma all of the time, 24/7. And so they're quite used to gunshot wounds and all the different other calamities that we encounter on a daily basis. Otherwise, just like everybody's been saying, it's like real bad places to be at. The whole idea, she is very similar to what I'd be hearing on programs like the Karen Hunter Show, you know, where it seems as though there's an understanding of racism, white supremacy, but still at the same time, I hear on the program people kind of like holding out hope that they are going to run into some white people that's going to sincerely contribute towards ending the system of racism or replacing it with a system of justice. I constantly hear that on some of these radio programs on, let's say, Sirius Radio, which is more in debt as opposed to more mainstream radio programs. So that's my take on the first reading. Thank you.
For sure. We have a few minutes before we get to the second audio segment. Anybody else have any other questions, problems, comments they want to make sure they got in?
Quickly, I had something. I was going to respond to the ethnic white, but you did it very eloquently. So I think that you summed it up, that's the same thing I took it as. And But when she wrote the article about President Reagan, which I thought she was pretty on point with some of her her past view with his presidency, creating that neoconic agenda during the 80s, with the way they handled foreign policy and domestic policy. But what she tied in the Black Panthers and everything into that. But I was shocked that she didn't tie Ronald Reagan in with that, because what he did to the Black Panthers in California is far worse than whatever happened in Chicago with the Black Panthers. He totally abused everyone's own rights and just killed them. Locked them up for years. And I feel like that she could have definitely hammered home that point that, he was definitely from that same era of doing that to the Panthers. I'll be my mom.
You going to say something, Gus?
I was just going to say good point and double check to make sure we didn't miss anybody who hasn't shared. Anybody who has not spoken at all? If not, we can give Roz's comment. Anybody who has not shared at all? All right, I guess we got everybody. Feel free, Roz.
All right, thanks. First, yes, I agree with both you and Thomas. Ethnic whites are basically Eastern Black Europeans, which are the most, from history, the most abused Europeans, the ones whose names end in Slav, like Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia. That term Slav is where the term slave comes from. So the original slaves were white people. They enslaved each other. So I just wanted to chime in with that. And then I still, even though you said that the exchange with Vrdoljak and the journalist Wiseman was a satire, I still found it telling, because I'm sure that entire experience was something that actually happened to him on multiple occasions, number one. Number two, I looked up the term satire just because I knew what it meant, but I just wanted to look it up anyway, and it actually means to make a mockery of someone and to tell a joke, and you always talk about paying attention to jokes, and if you look at that satire, that quote-unquote joke, that is exactly how the real world functions, and that's exactly how it functioned in reference to Mayor Harold Washington. And also, when you talked about, I forget the name of the essay that you said she had written, like, I think weeks or days before she passed away, I truly believe her depression was amplified and magnified due to that understanding dawning on her about white people, maybe somewhere in her mind, because she also has white family members, and maybe she came to a belief in her mind, because she talks about integration and miscegenation as a means of helping the race situation. I think when all of those walls crumbled,
that just destroyed her reality. It's almost like coming out of the Matrix, quote unquote, but you're unprepared for it. So there's a shot to the system, and I think that shot to the system manifested as her taking her own life. So, I mean, this book really hammers home the mental health issue and just really trying to be cognizant, like you said, not just this year, but every year, be as cognizant as possible about our mental health. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
For sure. We will get to our second audio segment. If you have commentary that you were not able to share thus far, just make a note, jot it down. We should have ample time for folks to share once the second audio segment concludes. I am eager because we're going to a new section. So the first portion of reading, this is the editor, her former husband, Clarence Page, him setting up, giving an introduction to the new section, and then we go back to her essays. But the first essay in the new section is about the quote-unquote Atlanta child murders, and that is something that we've done a lot of programs on here at the Cows, and I have a personal vested interest in. So eager to get started. Context of White Supremacy, Leonida McLean, audio segment number 2. This is Crime and Punishment.
Crime and punishment.
If the old saying that a conservative is just a liberal who has been mugged is to be believed, Leonida McLean might best be described as a modern urban conservative on crime issues. Early in her career, she was the victim of a purse snatching while covering a feature story at a public housing project. Later, she was robbed at gunpoint in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Growing up in housing projects, she knew the victims and perpetrators of violent crime firsthand. As a result, her view of urban street crime presented liberal ideas tempered with modern realities. She sympathized with the need to prevent crime by improving opportunities for inner city youth. She also knew police brutality was more than a myth and felt corrupt police should constantly be screened out. She also supported in her columns the need to provide legal help to those who cannot afford it and rehabilitative service in prisons for those who need it and will use it. But as McLean shows in writings about black street gang leaders and other notorious characters, she realized that some people are beyond rehabilitation and deserved nothing more than removal from law-abiding society. Having grown up in some of the lowest income, high crime areas of Chicago, she offers a view of the root of street crime that is based on firsthand knowledge. And she had little sympathy for criminals who grew up with the benefits of good homes and schools. They had much less excuse, she felt, than the vile street gang leaders of the inner city. Yet, they were much less likely to be severely punished. Crime was an important issue to McLean because it played a major role in the deterioration of cities, the exodus of commerce, and the destruction of human lives, particularly those of poor minorities. At the same time, there were few issues that frustrated her more than the way those who had the greatest ability to improve the situation seemed to persist in making it worse. September 28, 1981. Atlanta's victims on my mind. The ribbon was frayed and unsightly, but I could not bring myself to remove it, not just yet. The fraying, broken threads, evidence of last spring's assaulting winds and rains, are as symbolic as the ribbon itself. They show how much time has passed, how worn everyone has become, how difficult it was to unravel the case of the 28 murdered black young people in Atlanta. It had been months since I reached for a raincoat. The black, green, and red ribbon worn in sympathy for the suffering families was still attached to the collar. Hundreds of lapels and coat collars throughout the nation displayed the ribbons earlier this year, some simply green, others green and black, still others in red, black, and green.
They all had a common purpose, a common good. The Atlanta Braves even wore green tape on their batting helmets. Actor Robert De Niro had a touch of green on his tux when he accepted an Oscar. Many churches raise money for the families of the slain children by selling the ribbons. Some were fashioned into ingenious petaled creations, imitations of the real flowers that have decorated many a chapel and gravesite in Atlanta since the killings began in 1979. The tricolor ones, red for blood, black for skin color, and green for the earth and life, symbolize the Pan-African or Black nationalist movement, and in the 60s were unlikely to be worn by anyone who did not also bear a stern face and a clenched fist. But the colors gained new meaning with the Atlanta tragedy, and the color of the person wearing them was insignificant. The ribbons flapped in the unrelenting chill last spring as Chicagoans looked up for any sign of a delayed summer, for a burst of sunshine, as a break might occur for investigators in the Atlanta tragedy. But the ribbons would not be shed before the coats would be. The coats went into the closet for a season, but the Atlanta case dragged on. It dragged on until it became more than a crime story. In fact, it often became an event, and the true import of the story became blurred. A great many happenings began to swirl about the case, some well-intentioned, others ludicrous, insensitive, and sensational. There were marches across the country, celebrity benefit concerts, and charges that the police weren't trying hard enough, that no one cared because the children were black. More than $1 million in federal aid was sent to the Special Police Task Force. Mayor Burns sent $10,000 of her own money, and 5,000 people attended a rally in Washington. A parade of psychics entered the picture, each with his or her own composite psychic sketch of the killer. There was debate over the killer's race. The hunted suspect was a long-haired, mustachioed black man one week, a long-haired, scar-faced white man the next. Or was there more than one killer? The FBI offered a psychological sketch of a middle-aged gentleman with feminine tendencies, or possibly a woman. Sociologists talked about the wayward street child, and others suggested that some of the children were deep into the sordid side of street life, as if their loss would be any less significant. Special activities were organized for kids for the summer. Psychologists were quoted about the stress on Atlantans and the nightmares of the city's children, and a distressing letter from a 10-year-old published in papers nationwide beseeched the killer. If you like killing kids and it makes you feel good and happy, then you could be sick or something, and there are people who could help you. The Vigilante Guardian Angels Group flew to the rescue from New York. Residents of a low-income project where a few of the victims lived formed their own vigilante group and were arrested on arms violations. One of the mothers declared that the killings were being committed by a cult. Another said she suspected some of the other parents. Many of the families began to charge the media for being quotable, and ethical issues muddied the case even more. Then, incredibly, activist Dick Gregory suggested that the children were being used in experiments to manufacture an anti-cancer drug. And lastly, television is producing a docudrama on the subject. It has been a grim, curious, touching story that seems never-ending. Thankfully, no more names have been added to the list. But will the upcoming trial of Wayne B. Williams, the 23-year-old photographer charged in only two of the slayings, really tie up all the loose ends?
The nation's consciousness is as battered by this agonizing tale as the ribbon on my coat, but its scars cannot be removed as easily. February 1st, 1983. Grandma, get your gun. The anti-gun contingent should meet Dorothy and Little Pete. Dorothy, an arthritic but busy grandmother, never goes anywhere without Little Pete, her trusty 38. And if the people of such places as Morton Grove, whose gun ban recently was upheld, had to trudge from the bus stop to get to Dorothy's home in a Southside housing project day or night, they just might change their minds and adopt a Little Pete themselves. They might think twice, too, if their financial transactions were conducted in a dingy currency exchange, probably no bigger than their family rooms, that is a marvel of security hardware. The doorway often is obstructed by the local young men who, having no jobs, keep banker's hours on the walkway. Instead, most suburbanites have the luxury and security of a friendly neighborhood bank or S&L with friendly muzak and friendly guards and friendly tellers who bid everyone have a nice day, not to mention convenient mail and drive-in service and shiny computerized money spewers that would be foreign to Dorothy's neighbors, many of whom have never had checking accounts. Their tight monetary policy is cash or money order. That Social Security check is all Dorothy has, and she isn't about to let some young punk get away with it without a fight, whatever the consequences. Dorothy and many others like her, if their checks survive the mailboxes, have devised security systems as elaborate as the currency exchanges, carrying an empty handbag, sewing a hidden pocket in a coat, or the old-fashioned tucking into the bra or stockings. They often travel in groups for safety or have to wait for a relative to transport them by car to and from the door and occasionally leave their money in the relative's care altogether. Thieves know better than the government when and how its check system works. Most of Dorothy's neighbors are on some form of public assistance, and they stay home on the day the checks arrive. Even though the funds from the month before might have run dry, they'll wait a week or more to cash the new one to avoid the rush on purse snatching. Dorothy has heard the fuss about handguns. Yes, they were meant for nothing other than killing another human being. Yes, they are a leading cause of domestic homicides. Yes, there are unfortunate accidents with children. Yes, it is easier for criminals to get handguns than for honest citizens who go through waiting weeks for a state license and the 3 days cooling off period to pick up their gun after purchasing it. But no Little Pete stays put. The people of Morton Grove have put their faith into a handgun ban. She puts her faith in Little Pete. A ban may work in Morton Grove, but it won't work in her neighborhood, and neither will the city's gun law. The U.S. Court of Appeals upheld Morton Grove's law last month, giving more ammunition to both sides in the handgun issue. The ordinance forbids residents of Morton Grove to own handguns, except for antique gun collectors, licensed gun clubs, and the military and police. The court, in a 2-1 decision, said the law was constitutional, although it may not promote peace and security for its citizens. Judge John Coffey, in a pointed dissent, said Morton Grove, acting like the omniscient and paternalistic Big Brother in George Orwell's novel 1984, cannot, in the name of public welfare, dictate to its residents that they may not possess a handgun in the privacy of their home. There are no doubt more than a few decent citizens who have been turned into criminals by default since the Morton Grove law was enacted, as Dorothy and others in Chicago have been since the city's new law passed in April. At least Morton Grove had the guts to impose the ban. Chicago's convoluted new law is a roundabout and feeble facsimile.
Every time Dorothy steps from her door, for example, she is breaking the law that makes it illegal for anyone other than a law enforcement officer or guard traveling to and from work to carry a gun, to control handguns, or to ban them. As neither is 100% workable, the first option, with some semblance of cooperation between law enforcement and the average scared citizenry through registration, is best. Since every handgun everywhere is never going to be collected, people should be made to understand their power and awesomeness. That alone might lead to voluntary submission of handguns. The city might have done better to start an education and registration drive, which it is pretending to do now. By February 3rd, every registered owner must re-register all guns, not just handguns. Even those people who registered in a hurry in April. There had been registration since 1968. People should go to their police districts to register properly, with applications for each gun, photos for each gun, and one for police files, and a $5 total fee regardless of the number of guns. But remember, don't carry a gun with you or you're breaking the law. Yet anyone who failed to register a handgun before the April 9th deadline, or who has purchased a handgun since, because they could not register it because of the new law, already is in violation and faces a $500 fine or 6 months in jail. Those who want to buy guns of any kind may still do so, but no unregistered handgun can be kept in the city. Confused? Dorothy isn't. She and Lil Pete, as usual, will just mind their own business. June 18, 1983. Standing square on dope. Did you hear about Belinda? Asked Penny, one of those old high school friends you run into in theater lobbies and restaurants every 2 months or so. Penny's voice was ominous and her fingernails clamped tighter and tighter into my forearm. She's dead, Penny said. The ensuing how and when had no answer. No one knows, Penny said. We determined to find out. We were sorry when we did. Belinda, I've changed her name to avoid causing anyone pain, was one of the best dressed, most outgoing and flamboyant girls in the class of 68. Yearbook and newspaper staffs, honor society, science club, student council, girls athletic association. She died while freebasing, according to reluctant sources. Freebasing, made famous by the 1980 fire mishap of comedian Richard Pryor, involved smoking a concoction of ether and cocaine in a pipe. Belinda, an asthma sufferer, clogged up her respiratory system somehow and choked. Or so, with Pryor, the ether reportedly exploded and set his shirt afire, resulting in third-degree burns. While Belinda got a hurried and secretive funeral, Pryor got an additional routine out of his encounter with tragedy. What's this? He asked, lighting a match on stage and bouncing it through the air. Richard Pryor running, he answers. But there is little humor in what has become of the children of the 60s. As they graduated, so did drug use. You used to be a square to revive an expression that now seems ancient for not smoking pot. Curses to the party poopers in the circle who passed along to reefer without taking a drag, who ate pretzels all night because the brownies were laced with marijuana, who were not daring enough to try LSD. Now, marijuana is a common household item, right next to the lettuce in the refrigerator vegetable crisper. A midnight smoke before bedtime or a few puffs before sex are essentials to many people, most of whom, surprisingly, are still prudish enough in their approaching midlife to keep it from their children. But there are those who don't even keep it from the children. Soon, snorting cocaine will be just as common if the price of this high-priced high ever goes down. It's nearly impossible to powder your nose in the restroom in some rush street spots because of the white powder that some people are snorting. They do lines. The pharmacy neat laying out of a row of cocaine atop the metal cigarette machines. Their offers to strangers to pay up and join in are as distressing as the old image of the pusher at the school ground fence. The shimmering ambiance makes the practice no less grimy. Because of the generational kinship, those who do not indulge are unsuspectingly drawn into the sport. They are accepted spectators because of the participants' presumption that a shared age brings with it a shared morality. And this is causing an intra-generation gap. What do you do when a party guest disappears into the bathroom and leaves that funny cigarette aroma behind? Or when another guest boldly lays out rolled cigarettes amid the cheese and crackers? This is carrying a bring-your-own invitation a bit too far. And reprimand is met with a standard retort. After all, everyone's doing it, so it must be all right. Everyone is doing it, so much so that to denounce it publicly can be an unintentional insult to everyone within hearing. Why is it that those who do not indulge are left feeling ashamed, accused of moral holiness, and seldom believed? For those intolerants who remain squares, who do not share the permissive attitudes of their contemporaries, the scorn and taunts are sometimes as great as any peer pressure suffered during the teen years. Obviously, given such widespread drug use, so too is the lack of will to refuse to go along. But many squares still do stand square on the issue. I've made it clear that no one brings any of that stuff into my house, said a friend who is now married to a lawyer, has two children, a dog, a mortgage, and all of the rest that our generation scorned, not perceiving that time and money would make them the norm. We did not expect that drugs would be the norm too. I won't tolerate it. I don't understand it. Why do these people with money and good jobs and fancy vacations need it? Why indeed? Penny and I would like to have asked her if she thought about her little boy whenever she did this. Now all we can do is ask each other why and plan a reunion before we lose anyone else. September 28, 1983. Legal services for poor in jeopardy. The Reagan administration has tried to throttle, starve, and dismember Legal Services Corp. Now it has resorted to sheer humiliation and harassment. It has gagged the 9 regional offices of the Poor People's Law Firm from contact with the media and elected officials. In addition, it has proposed changes in eligibility that would drop more poor people through the safety net. As usual, the ultimate goal is to rid the nation of this public service, to deny the poor due process of law. There are even fears that its conservative detractors, having failed to kill it, will recycle it into Judicare, a concept that would pay private attorneys to represent the poor, an approach similar to school tax vouchers. Since his election, the president has schemed persistently against the agency, arguing that it is too costly, that its states should decide whether to use their block grants to fund such programs, and that with its class action suits, it is a thorn in the side of the very government that funds it. Fortunately, Congress is not as heartless and has saved it, sometimes just barely. The president's first assault on the agency was
to turn over its board of directors to a pack of conservative wolves in sheep's clothing. Their mission was to dismantle, not salvage, the agency. But this backfired. They were found last December to have billed the agency for $156,000 in consulting fees, double those of the year before. With typical White House logic, the response of presidential counselor Edwin Meese was that there would be no such controversy if the agency did not exist. The General Accounting Office investigated this fiasco and has exonerated the board, but the embarrassment is lasting. And, of course, every year the president has asked that the agency be eliminated. Last year, he was rescued again, but the budget was trimmed by about 25%, from $320 million to $240 million. In the last 2 weeks, there has been a new barrage, the gag order, a change in eligibility rules that will cut still more clients, the GAO allegations that the corporation misused public funds by lobbying to save its own budget. The revelation conveniently timed just as the reauthorizing legislation is before Congress. The eligibility rules, which could take effect today, will hurt the elderly, handicapped, and unemployed the most. They would maintain the eligibility of people with incomes no higher than 25% above the official poverty level, but then require that other government benefits that were formerly excluded be counted, plus the income of everyone in an applicant's household. Battered women could not be aided unless they lived in shelters. And last, they would deny service to anyone who had more than $15,000 equity in a home, which omits a good portion of senior citizens. Obviously, these are not the most pleasant of times for attorneys in the program. "We're under siege," says one with 4 years service. What it boils down to is that we are going to spend more time checking into the eligibility of clients than representing them. It's going to get more stringent than public aid. Sheldon Rodman has taken the federal beatings in stride as executive director of the Legal Assistance Foundation of Chicago, the independent nonprofit corporation that is chief conduit of Legal Services Corp. Funds in the city were an estimated $30,000 could be served. Rodman, chief for 6 years, has had to eliminate 25 of some 100 lawyers and one of 7 offices as resources shrank. "We are merely giving advice to some people now, telling them how to represent themselves in court when we would have actually represented them," he said. He defends the agency's purpose with zeal. "There has been an enormous expansion in the rights of the poor, and it has been the full-time professionals in neighborhood offices who have made this so effective. It is hogwash to believe that lawyers in private practice on a voluntary basis could replace the service being provided. That was the reason for legal services in the first place. The poor were not being given access to our system of justice. At issue really is a clash of philosophies. The administration holds that legal services lawyers are all do-gooder lefties. That is a compliment considering they aren't getting rich at $17,500 to $29,000 a year. The Reagan philosophy is simply callous. He seems to think anyone who can't pay $200 an hour to a lawyer with a fancy mahogany paneled office doesn't deserve any lawyer. November 2nd, 1983. Money won't stop street gangs. Evanston is a suburb on the north shore of Lake Michigan. Unlike its sister suburbs in the area, Evanston has a substantial black population. For every E On my report card, Father used to give me 50 cents. Was I ever cheated? That was small change compared with a proposal put forth by the Evanston branch of the NAACP to have the city identify the 100 worst gang members and pay their families $100 a week if they turn good. For me, good performance was expected, no payoff or no. And I understood the reciprocal agreement that there would be unpleasantness from my father's right hand had the grades not been good. So too should it be with the kids in Evanston. The NAACP's proposal was a serious one, but fortunately it has not been taken seriously. It was one of three ideas, each one as absurd as the others, to help Evanston politicians and community workers find ways to tackle this urban problem that has found its way across Howard Street. The NAACP's suggestions should be an embarrassment to the group. This is a classic case of wanting to toss money at a problem but ignore the cause of it. The family that cannot discipline a child is not going to be able to do so any better with an extra $100, no matter how many circus tickets or other extracurricular activities it might provide. Enough studies have shown that family instability is the prime contributor to gangs. The $100 isn't going to stabilize a family or help parents do what should come naturally. There are, of course, good parents with bad kids, but paying even them won't make their kids better. On the other hand, will penalizing parents make for better kids? Evanston Mayor James Little has a counterproposal to fine parents $500 and 6 months in prison if teenagers violate curfew or alcohol or drug laws in the parents' home. Money, either as reward or punishment, will not root out the evil of street gangs, but both proposals at least recognize the real problem, parenting, though they have not found the right answer. Specifically, the NAACP proposed that the $100 subsidy be awarded to any parents who will ensure that their previously disruptive child, those who have been identified by the police department as the main 100 youths who are gang members and who are destroying the tranquility of the community, conducts himself or herself in acceptable social standards. Unacceptable social behavior was quickly righted in my childhood with a stern look because the next phase of disciplinary action was too painful to think about, much less test. The NAACP also would require parents to attend a monthly workshop covering the subjects of employment, parenting, developing human potential, human development, and positive thinking. This part of their idea doesn't seem quite so ridiculous, given the number of gang members and just plain aimless and lonely kids at all income levels. But is it the government's responsibility to teach people to be parents? Evanston's only obligation beyond human relations is to use that $100 a week on supervised activities or on facilities and equipment. Saving the family should be the business of the Evanston NAACP through counseling parents and children about their responsibilities to the greater community. The NAACP also suggested earlier curfew hours and a $50 fine if parents fail to receive a city permit to hold a party for youths under 18. The permit allows no more than 30 youths for each bathroom in the house. 30 youths per bathroom? What about half baths? Sure, such ideas did not need to be suggested to parents in times past. If father said to be in from a date at midnight, then a minute after was pushing it. The only permit needed to keep parties under control was the group of mothers making potato salad in the kitchen who peeked in on the dance floor every quarter hour. What the Evanston rules are talking about is plain old-fashioned discipline, and it shouldn't have to be bought or sold or bargained for between city government and individual families or between a parent and child. It should be expected, and the expectation alone should be enough incentive. Times have changed, of course. Drugs, drinking, and teen sex have all confounded approaches to child rearing, but they have not made it impossible. And there is sympathy aplenty for the woman heading a household, living on tight finances in fear of her 6-foot baby boy and his pot-smoking buddies. But only an investment of human capital will solve this social ill.
Context of white supremacy. That will wrap us up for this week. We should have 2 of these sessions left, and we will be all done. And just an FYI for people who don't have the book, with each section, the articles reset in terms of the chronological order. So the articles that we just read, the crime and punishment section, they started in 1981 with the piece on the quote-unquote Atlanta child murders and ending in November of 1983 with Money Won't Stop Street Gang. So chronological order reset, just to make sure folks are clear. So we're about 6 months from when she commits suicide, the last piece that we read. Anywho, folks that dialed in, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Please, let's not lollygag. If you have comments you would like to share, go ahead, dial in now. Get your hand up so we don't have people waiting until the very last minute to make a comment. Let's see. We have with us Mr. Demery Ford, Thomas in New York, Roz, our narrator, caller in Michigan, our retired firefighter, and I think Karma should still be with us as well. If you all had commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, one last thing from the last reading. When they were talking about Reagan administration's proposal to violate basic rights by causing people to self-incriminate themselves using lie detectors. They were going to use the tests on federal employees and government contractors trying to avoid a leak in classified material. It brings to mind the Patriot Act of nowadays and the right to hack into cell phones. It's just another violation of privacy, and it's just the way the system of white supremacy works. There was a section of when Grandma Get Your Gun, Dorothy, a grandmother who had the 38 with her. You know, if you're in a situation like this, a high crime area, I thought about that, you know, and you're living in those high rise structures and people on top of one another, and they cramped into these spaces. You know, creates a violent situation. And so if she was just going to the mailbox to get a Social Security check or whatever, she may be mugged. So it's quite natural that she would have some type of protection on her, you know, which brings up other issues dealing with the law. And different states is different, but a concealed weapon permit. One incident that happened recently, a couple of young men were being robbed, and one had a gun. So when he tried to take his car, and I think this happened in Chicago, too, just recently, the perpetrator was shot and killed, and there's no word on what happened to the shooter or whether he had a concealed permit, which probably he didn't. But I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure. Other folks have commentary they want to make sure they get in. Should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, man, I think he's doing an excellent job of pointing out the so-called economics.
Your line is breaking up. Your line is breaking up.
Is this better?
That's an improvement.
Hello?
That's an improvement.
Yes, yes. I was saying she did a great job, I think, of breaking down the Reaganomics, you know, the trickle-down economics, how it's supposed to work. Let's cut out all the social services and, you know, some good, kind-hearted white people are just, you know, pick up this tab. It's just, you know, ridiculous. And a lot of what she's talking about, the crime in the projects, which, you know, went on for years in Chicago. And then, you know, they started knocking down the projects and all of the criminal elements moved throughout the city. And it's caused the element that, you know, you have today where it's just a rampant crime rate, a lot of shootings. A lot of this has to do with knocking down those projects instead of making them better, more conducive living environments. And I'm not sure if I like that $100 a week thing myself. I just don't see how that would be helping. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Other folks have commentary. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I found a couple things very interesting in this reading. There was when the essay she wrote about the Atlanta child murders. I was just saying, I found it interesting that when she wrote that piece, she singled out Robert De Niro wearing green on his tux when he accepted an Oscar. I kind of see that as a subtle form of white validation. And it looks like she kind of gave white people quite a bit of credit at one point. She talks about it didn't matter who the color of the person who was wearing the colors. So I just think it kind of alludes to some of that. And then I found it interesting in the section where she talks about, in the same essay, this one, 125, she says the FBI offered a psychological sketch after she gives the discussion on the psychics, and she said a middle-aged gentle man with feminine tendencies or possibly a woman. And because usually I know with the FBI, when they do psychological sketches, they tend to be fairly accurate. So I just found it interesting that it was a person who seemed to be antisexual who they are looking at as far as a psychological sketch in the Atlanta child murders. I just found that to be kind of interesting. It stood out to me as well. Oh, yes, the section on page 126 where she, Grandma, go get your gun, where she said, thieves know better than the government when and how its check system works. Most of Dorothy's neighbors are on some form of public assistance, and they stay home on the day the checks arrive. Even though the funds from the month before might have run dry, they'll wait a week or more to cash the new one to avoid the rush on purse snatching. And it was just interesting because it brought me back to my childhood because I remember before crack came to town, it was very similar to that where a lot of the older people who were receiving public assistance would do just that because purse snatchings would go up. And I actually came up in a fairly decent section of Brooklyn, but it still used to happen in my area too. And then I remember after crack, a lot of people would, basically drug dealers made their most money on the first of the month. They even made rap songs about it. So I just, it just brought me back to my childhood as far as that experience and how similar it was even back then. Also, I found it in that same section how they make it hard for black people in areas that have a lot of crime to own weapons, and I find that to be there's a long history of denying black people access to guns, especially in situations where they might need them simply because they're in areas that are high crime and they want to feel safe and protected when they're trying to just get their money and live their lives. So I just found it telling that they really make it so bad that an elderly woman had to go the illegal route just to get a gun in order to keep safe. And I just find that to be a pattern throughout a lot of black neighborhoods and inner city neighborhoods. I thought that in the section, Standing Square on Dope, when she discussed marijuana and snorting cocaine and talking about eventually it'll be just as common, to me, this kind of speaks of the precursor to what's happening now as far as them wanting to legalize drugs, talking about now legalizing heroin. So, I mean, it's like it's just interesting, kind of like a prophetic little section that she wrote in that area. And then section, the very last section where she talks about money won't stop street gangs. It made me think because recently I was listening to Tando radio show, and he actually played a clip, and they were talking about in Washington, D.C., they adopted that in recent months where they're paying gang members up to $1,000 a month not to commit crime, and especially gun crimes in particular, not to shoot people, not to shoot their rivals. And there's like a whole program that they instated in the D.C. area, and basically they said that they have not measured it. They did not have any sort of measurements for the program, but essentially he talked about on that show, he talked about how the U.S. government will pay like gang members or pay people like the Taliban and then train them to eventually terrorize the people who they're living amongst. And he basically alluded to them doing the same thing with these gang members eventually in the United States, basically paying them off and then putting them into the programs that basically turn them against their own people, but they're working for the government. So I just found that very interesting. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you.
Any folks have other comments they want to make sure they get in before we wrap things up? Any other comments, folks? I don't know if folks are satisfied or not. I will at least make sure I get in some of the things that stood out for me. The lots I could say on the quote-unquote Atlanta child murders piece, that's from 1981. We've done a lot of programs on that over the years. That's one that I can say I've read quite a bit, different selections. I read the book that she mentioned a few weeks back, James Baldwin's book, Evidence of Things Not Seen. One of the, out of many things that I could say, the first, in terms of she said that there had not been any additional names added to the list. The very first program that we did here at the COWS back in 2009, Chet Detlinger, his book appropriately titled The List on the quote-unquote Atlanta child murders, he said he goes into detail in his book, and we did so on the program, about how whites who were in charge of that list, they were just able to decide willy-nilly. You had all kinds of black people being murdered, whether they were children or quote unquote adults at that time. And it had just ended up almost being kind of random as to who got on the list, who did not get on the list. Sometimes it was if the victim's family members could protest and get enough attention, they could get on the list. If not, they didn't get on the list. And it certainly, he talks in great detail that it served many people's interests, most foremostly, I would say, racist white supremacists, white people in Atlanta, it served their interest to at least have people believe that these killings stopped once Wayne Williams was in custody. And that it certainly would have been very easy in Atlanta or any other major city to continue to add up names of missing black children, murdered black children, and murdered black adults. Even though I do appreciate with her piece, it's titled Atlanta's Victims on My Mind. She didn't say children, but that is a common misnomer. We talked about that on the program as well. People referencing this case as the quote unquote Atlanta child murders when no one was ever, not Wayne Williams or anybody else, no one was ever convicted. No one was ever charged in connection with this case to a single child murder, single missing child, kidnapping, nothing. Wayne Williams was convicted of killing two adults, and one of those adults was added to the list later. And even that, like he goes into a lot, it's a lot I could say about it because it's a very detailed case, but I also thought some of Roz's observations as well about
how kind of giving some kudos to Robert De Niro and some of these other whites for whatever they did, acknowledging this case. There was a lot of that going on at the time, even though this is another really pitiful, forceful example of the lack of value for black lives. The piece, Grandma Get Your Gun, they repealed this law, Morton Grove, Illinois, this part of Chicago. It was repealed in 2008. And I think in Illinois, they recently even had legislation that made it legal for people to have their concealed carry permits. Again, white people set up the problem to begin with, where they, as exactly was spelled out. And this is a long legacy. One of the things that I do appreciate about this, I've said consistently, I think Thomas in New York has brought this up and others, when they talk about Chicago and having the quote unquote high murder rate and lots of black people dying and what have you, that this is not new. And I don't think if you do not understand racism, white supremacy in depth and have a historical appreciation for the terrorism that whites have targeted against black people in that area for decades, you will, you know, be thinking, oh, man, this is crazy. I can't believe this has happened. This is what it's always been in the area of Chicago. And whites are most to blame for this. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. I thought it was important, both in this piece and in the final piece that we did, the segment on street gangs. Make sure I get the title, Money Won't Stop Street Gangs, where she is talking about these. Where she's talking about street gangs. She references these young black people as gangs. I've said consistently, the Verdoli Act 29, that is a gang. And I would just say in that use of words alone, it's the same thing if you want to think about terrorism. Who gets classified as a terrorist? Who gets classified as a gang? We don't think of Edward Burke, Edward Verdoliak. We don't think of them as a gang, but we will think of these black people in Chicago who are struggling, who have nothing. And this is not I think she talks about it in the book. Oh, they're just products of their environment, blah, blah, blah. Well, at the end of the day, if we do have a system of racism, white supremacy, and whites in Chicago and elsewhere, but since we're just talking about Chicago, have for decades made sure that black people have nothing. You're going to have inferior schools. You're not going to have health care. You're not going to have jobs. You have the worst of everything. And we're going to make sure that we do this forever. You might not even have a place to stay. We had the program from last year, Beryl Satter, Family Property, where she talks a lot. It was total war. And that's the way she, and matter of fact, I asked her, she said it was economic terrorism to make sure that black people were not property owners so that you don't have a place to stay. We can take your house if you've paid 75% of what the cost of the property is and you miss a payment. We can take the whole thing and you've lost everything. You're out on the street, and we do this for generations, do this for decades. So then if you end up having no value and just say, forget it, I don't care about anything, let's just go out and shoot people and rob old ladies and take their Social Security checks or what have you, whites have set up everything to produce that. White people aren't thought of as the gangs. It's just the black people that are the gangs that we need to do something with, whether it's this little tacky program, we give them $100 or whatever the case may be, or we, you know, go after the parents and say it's their fault because you did a poor job parenting, or whatever solutions we come up with. We do not go at what is responsible for this to begin with, and that would be white people like Edward Verdoliak and the rest of the whites that have been named and not named in this text, Richard Daley, the mayor, and what have you. The piece on the segment that she did on drugs, Standing Square on Dope, that was from 1983, about a little less than a year before her death. Wow, particularly with everything that's being talked about right now, you could just change the date and put 2016 on this, and wow, she was way ahead of her time. Absolutely, with everything that we're seeing now. Now it's just legalize everything. Legal, the cannabis is right next to the lettuce and the CRISPR, and we should go ahead and have everything be legalized. And I think I suspect she would probably be one of the few voices who would be saying that I don't think that this is going to work out in our best interest long term. It seems like she had that understanding at that time, and I would say she is absolutely correct, prescient in her analysis. This is about almost 25 years in advance of where we happen to be at right now. The legal services piece I thought was great. I thought Thomas in New York, great job, very indicative of what was happening. Again, this is not looked at as gangsters and how they are ruling the plantation. We'll make sure that we have a system set up where the quote-unquote slave catchers, the race soldiers, police officers can go out and nab up black people, because we already know we have this setup where they are going to be out in areas to nab black people, not white people. And then once they do so, they won't even have constitutional legal representation to defend themselves when they go to the racist court structure. Should be definitely kept in mind. This is the era of John Birch. They just passed the reparations bill in Chicago for black people who suffered for decades. At this time, this is when all of this was happening, when black people were being terrorized, taken into custody by John Burge's thugs, having electrical prods put on their testicles and what have you. You go through all that, and we're going to make sure you don't even get a lawyer to assist you at the end of all this, to make sure you don't get all this unjust time in the Windy City. Just the levels, the layers of terrorism that are operating here. I think with that, I will pause to see if anybody has any other commentary that they want to make sure they get in. Anybody that we hadn't heard from for the second portion have commentary they want to make sure they got in? Everyone is satisfied. Any commentary?
Yeah, I had one comment to make. But keep in mind, because this is political season, and this book is a lot of politics, and I find a lot of black people I meet, I find them to be, they consider themselves to be Democrats before they're black. And I just wanted to point out that all these people in Chicago that has done this to these black people, these are all Democrats. All Democrats, the Democratic agenda, the liberalist national agenda, is written right there in the University of Chicago. So these are all Democrats, all these aldermen, all of the from the mayor, from Daley to now Emanuel, all Democrats. And you see the schools getting shut down. You see the massive injustice that goes on here today. All done at the hand of the Democrats. Just want to point that out.
Chicago, notoriously Democratic city. I think it's been more than half century since they've had a Republican mayor in the city of Chicago, which I guess, again, probably not saying as much, because they've only had two mayors over the last nearly two decades, Richard M. Daley and Rahm Emanuel. Anything else? Folks want to make sure they got in. If anybody had any observations in terms of what they've seen in terms of the evolution or changes in her mental health, or at least what you can kind of perceive, extrapolate from the readings as we've been moving along through the text chronologically, basically. Anything stood out, or are folks satisfied?
I have an observation. I do. I think, you know, you run into these people who you just can't seem to just lay that blame at white people's feet. They always revert back to, you know, saying black people are equally to blame, or maybe most to blame, but they just can't do it. And these are smart black people, sharp black people, people who protest a fierce loyalty to being black and say that they are in no way anti-black, and they just can't do it, even though they see it and they kind of get it. I think that those people are just getting too much reward out of it. Those black people. I mean, she's getting a lot of reward out of this system. I don't think it's the, you know, the family thing or whatever. I mean, you know, she's raking in the accolades and the money and the status, and even though she's still a victim of racism, she's getting rewarded. And that's what I'm seeing in a lot of black people who, even though they profess to see it, and they just can't seem to really come to terms and just accept that white people are responsible. They're usually getting quite a bit out of that, you know?
I hear that.
pretty frequent. I think that was Mr. Demery before. I was just going to say, I hear that often where other victims, they have surmised that that's what's happening with a lot of victims. I haven't, I guess, you know, in the last 2 minutes that we have, I didn't really get the sense that Ms. McLean was reaping massive benefits. I'll put it this way. I didn't get the sense that whatever, quote unquote, benefits or gains that she was being allocated from the system of racism outweighed the trauma that she was experiencing. And that seems to come through pretty, at least for me, that seems to come through powerfully in her writing and, you know, how she died. Mr. Demery Ford, were you going to say something?
Yes. I wanted to comment. I listened to an interview that Clarence Page was given, and he made reference to relations with white people that he had had, and also he mentioned that Ms. McLean had recently had a new boyfriend and they were buying a house together, and based upon her writings and a lot of the things she said about Jewish people and the different rituals that they have, I know I didn't know anything about. It seems that she knew quite a bit about the Jewish culture, so to speak, and which may allude to the fact that her boyfriend that she was going to buy the house with may have been a white person. Also, it was interesting that it's 50 aldermen in Chicago, and if you take into consideration that the majority of them were white and male, then you can get an idea of what Mayor Washington was up against. And also, the mention of Dorothy Tillman, you know, was important. I didn't know much about her, but she ended up becoming an alderman in the third ward. And I'll mute my line on that. Thanks.
Right on. Right on. We will wrap things up. We are almost done. I think we have two sessions left, and we will wrap things up with the text. So folks, if you want to be thinking of your concluding thoughts on the text or anything that stands out as we get ready to wrap up, kind of be processing that over the next week or two, because we should max, like guarantee, we should only have two of these left and we will be all done. She certainly, I know in the text, she mentioned a lot of the trips that they took, going around the world, doing some globe trotting and that sort of thing. And I think she was the first black female writer in the history of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. And she, I think Mr. Page, her former husband, talked about she got a lot of accolades and promotions and that sort of thing, and seemed like she got a nice house and what have you. And even I think she's written about some of the guilt that she felt about that, seeing black people that she went to school with and grew up with. Certainly it didn't seem like she had a lot of that access to those type of resources growing up from what we've covered in the text, but it certainly doesn't seem like that outweighed what she saw happening on the whole, and even what she was experiencing. And I think the same thing with Max Robinson. I can go all the way back so we can do full circle as we conclude. When I started with Max Robinson, because I think they're contemporaries. He also was a journalist at the same time, is kind of viewed as a trailblazer for black journalists. He was in the Chicago area. He also died untimely. He talked about racism in the journalism profession, no less. His brother, Randall Robinson, said the same thing, that he had gotten a lot of awards. He got a lot of money, had a lot of stuff, had a lot of fame. He was on television on a regular basis, but he certainly was not happy. And it seemed that racism had a big part in his lack of being satisfied with what was happening. You know, see the logic, and have heard that a lot before, that people think some victims are reluctant to be honest about racism, white supremacy, because they don't want to lose what goodies racists have allowed. But at least for these two, I don't know. Doesn't seem like the goodies outweighed the trauma that they were experiencing and the trauma that they were observing around them. But folks can process. If y'all have other comments you want to share on that, feel free. We should have two sessions left to offer further analysis, further thought. We'll be back tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Workplace racism news notes from the past 7 days. Looking forward to hearing from folks. If you have problems, questions, gripes, complaints, suggestions, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. I will suggest again, as always, I know it's getting warmer and people are doing stuff outside and all that good stuff. Grand. You should still be codified. I will echo Ms. McLean's comments. Sobriety would be best under conditions of war. You never know when you're going to bump into a race soldier, whether they are an officer in uniform, Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, or just your regular white citizen. They can cause a variety of problems, including lethal life-ending problems. You want to keep that in mind. It would be best for us to be lucid, clear-thinking, so we can make the best possible decision to keep ourselves safe and any other non-white people that we might be responsible for. Clearly, if you're going to be in a vehicle, you want to buckle up every time, whether you are driver, passenger, even a pedestrian, buckled up and sober when you go out. And I would encourage, really try to curtail being out late. Again, I know people want to be out and frolic and what have you. I just, in my assessment, the current climate of racism, white supremacy, they are looking to intensify direct violence against black people. Being out late, I think that is a prime time for those sort of activities to occur. Again, whether it's enforcement officials or just your regular white citizen. With that, we'll be back in about 24 hours. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Gao signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.